It's showtime.
Kincaid, 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bycod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! And here we go. We are indeed off and running on this 13th day of February 2018. This is The Horn, headonradionetwork.com, and headon.live are where we live. There's access there for you from either portal to get to the Horn chat room, the Madcap Multimedia Zany Wacky real-time extravaganza that takes place in the 3 hours in which this program is live each night from each evening from 6 to 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time, 3 to 6 p.m. Pacific Standard Time. And if you pick yourself out a screen name and a password, folks will be happy to see you. And you will be capably moderated by longtime, inveterate, indefatigable veteran chat room moderator Sparky, who being a, even though he is a Spacing Guild Master, has decided not to fold space and become Man Cave, capably assisted by his, by midweek pinch hit utility chat room moderator Steve from Georgistan, all around great guy. All right, so we've got that part taken care of. 2 minutes past the hour. Thanks go out to our subscribers for this day of the month, the 13th. Thanks very kindly to Gary in Hood River, and thank you very kindly to Scott, our buddy in the chat room, VT Blom, in there right now. Scott in Florida, thank you very kindly. That's it for subscribers, and we're always looking for more. You can be one. Just go to the PayPal interface under the Contribute tab at headonradionetwork.com, and, you know, check that little box that says, I want this to repeat each month, or whatever it is it says there. Hey, there's Rhonda wandering into the chat room. Good evening, Rhonda. Welcome aboard. I want to dispense with some of the front of the program stuff. We'll get to that soon enough. But last night I had what I hope was an uplifting conversation to share with you. And this evening, again, the same. Not the same conversation, mind. Oh, hi, I'm Bob Kincaid. There, okay, that's out of the way. Yeah, radio egomaniacs. No, I wanted to share another good story with you. I wanted to share with you something that will remind us that human decency still lives in the world. You may recall, a couple of weeks back, down in the Kansas City area, a chemistry professor who has been in the United States for 30 years, who has taught countless students, who does volunteer work, who does research at local hospitals, who has, in fact, raised a lovely family here in the United States of America. He was taking his daughter to school when the ice creeps rolled up and handcuffed him and dragged him away and told his beloved wife that if she tried to hug him, that by God, they'd take her down too. Nice folks, ICE. And so they shattered that American, distinctly American family. This is happening all over the United States. A Polish-born physician, was dragged away by the ice men. I do not have a high regard for the people in ICE, and, well, that's just how it is. There are better things to do with our money and our time in the United States than torment decent human beings, but we live in the era of Trump, and as a consequence of that, I guess it's part of the whole pastiche of Trump-merica. But it doesn't have to be that way. And there are people with the courage to stand up against that kind of behavior. And I just happen to have on the phone with me right now from Big Sky Country out in Montana way, I have Jordan Deardall Roberts, who was, emphasis on the word was, an employee of the state of Montana until he was confronted with his own moral Rubicon. Jordan, are you with us? Do I have a good connection to you?
Am I coming through?
You sound great. Sound like you're sitting right next to me.
All right. Sounds good. Well, thank you for having me on.
Oh, it's an absolute pleasure. Your story got legs in a hurry and went around the country, and for good reason, because this is one of those moments when people stand up against forces of tremendous power arrayed against them. Let's just talk a little bit about what it was you were doing and how long you'd done it and that sort of thing. Like I said before, you were working for the state of Montana, right?
Yeah. I had worked for the state since 2008. First, I was in the public defender's office as a legal secretary and then moved to the Department of Labor end of 2011. And, you know, it's legal secretary work. I push paper, I maintain files, I had, again, yeah, that past tense.
Yeah, it's been, tough to get used to, isn't it?
You know, I keep finding myself saying I have to get used to that past tense, and it's taken a while because I mean I put in quite a lot of time in that job, and I like overall enjoyed the job I was doing. Like I sort of felt like I was contributing in a way. Like we, you know, the Department of Labor does good work. You know, making sure people get paid, making sure that workplaces are safe. Those are good things.
Making sure that employers follow the rules for wage and hour, and you know, don't bilk their employees out of what's right. I imagine that felt a little bit like working on the side of the angels, didn't it?
You know, most of the time it was great. Yeah, because I mean, yeah, it was a. I'm not going to lie, it was a lot of work. Like that's one of the reasons why I sort of, you know. Like there's this thing where people are like, well, you know, this has been going on for a while. It's like, you know, they passed subpoenas on before. It's like, well, you know what? It's unfortunate, but very possible that in that sort of, you know, busy work, I might have just, you know, pushed something off my desk. Like, oh yeah, subpoena, sure, here you go. But it was Tuesday afternoon. You know, an attorney came by and I was in the middle of something else. Just, you know, trying to get some work done, and swung by my desk and said, hey, be on the lookout for these ICE subpoenas tomorrow. And because I was in the middle of something else, I didn't like fully comprehend what he had said. I latched onto the words subpoenas and tomorrow. And the rest of the sentence was superfluous at that point, because I was trying to get something else done. I was like, okay, yeah.
Yeah, it wouldn't have been tomorrow. The first subpoena of any sort you had ever seen come through there, right?
No, those were a fairly regular occurrence. Just, you know, random bits of information people were requesting for X lawsuit or, you know. So I got home and I had what I refer to as the refrigerator moment. You know, like usually it's something you do where like you saw a movie and like you thought it worked out fine. Then you open up the refrigerator and go, wait a minute, that didn't work. There's a huge plot hole. Well, for me, it was like I, you know, open the fridge, and then as the light goes on in the fridge, the light goes on above my brain, and it was like, wait a minute.
Ding!
He said ice. But yeah, exactly. It was like, No, he couldn't have said ice, and I started doubting what I had heard.
Well, yeah, and let me ask you. I mean, it sounds like there was some cognitive dissonance there. Sort of, what in the world would ice be having to do with what I do in my everyday life? Was it that kind of thing?
Exactly, because I mean, it was like I had gone to sleep. It wasn't the best night of sleep I had because I was like, did he say ice? No, he didn't say ice. I can go to sleep. Wait, no, he said ice. No.
Okay, it's obvious that when that light did go on, I mean, ice. You already had a working knowledge of what ICE is doing to our country right now. Is that safe to say?
Oh, yeah. I mean, let me be straight with you. Like, ICE has never been my favorite organization.
I don't like them at all, so you're among friends.
Yeah, so, but they've kind of, there was sort of this understanding that they would pretend to be a law enforcement organization before, that veneer of civility is they don't even feel they need to bother with anymore. So yeah, like the next morning I get to work and thinking about it, and I get to work a little earlier than everyone else. So I had, plenty of time to stew in my own juices.
Right. And
so
let's,
I sent a text.
Yeah. And let's just, as a little bit of background, this is not you just going home to your little shoebox-sized bachelor pad. You're married.
Yep, you've got almost a decade.
You've got a toddler.
Yep.
And all that goes...
Coming up, I'm four.
All that goes with that. And so, whatever cognitive dissonance you were experiencing came with the other side of the balance with your family in it. And that sets up the totality of the, well, that sets up the universe of your decision-making process. And so then you go into work the next morning, right?
Yeah. And I sort of come to realize, of course ICE is going to start asking for information. Like that was the thing they would do. So when I left, my wife and child were still asleep. So I shoot this quick text to my wife, like, hey, when you are up and about, give me a call. And so she calls me not too long after that, and I step away from my desk and tell her, so they're asking me to process these ICE subpoenas, and I don't think I can do that. And so I was expecting a bit of a conversation, shall we say, because what I was saying was, I'm going to, shoot a hole in our whole plan. She had a couple days before she was going to register for her last semester of grad school, or last quarter. Sorry, they do quarters at UW.
Right.
And then the idea was she was going to get her master in library and information sciences, and then she'd find a job that had insurance, and then I would be able to put in a sort of steady resignation, I'll stick around and train the next person, and then I would go off and I was going to go back to school for computer programming. We had a plan. It was a nice plan.
Yeah, it sounds workable.
But it seemed workable. But we didn't have a conversation. As soon as I said that, without a moment's hesitation, my wife says, okay. And that was it. We were on the same page. And so, I said, all right, I love you. Goodbye.
And so, when you reach that understanding, your knowledge of whatever these subpoenas were going to be, you had enough knowledge about them to know that they were not going to be good for people. Is that a safe assumption?
Because I tapped out before I was going to be a party to this, but there's no other reason ICE would be asking the Department of Labor for information. They're not the Department of Immigration and Kittens.
They don't deliver birthday cakes or anything. No, not that.
Yeah, no. It was it was fairly obvious what they were like, no matter what information they were looking for, they've got one purpose right now. So the attorney came in and I gave him a minute to catch up, you know, morning emails, whatever. I went in and I said, so about the subpoenas you mentioned yesterday. And he's like, oh yeah, thank you for reminding me. And I said, can I clarify? when you said ICE, you were talking about, you know, Immigration Customs Enforcement, ICE. Yeah. And I was like, I don't think I can do that. And things, like, we sat and had a little bit of a conversation. And then it was talking to my manager and to HR. And the thing of it is that everyone was, you know, really nice about it. And there were people who put in like a genuine effort. They were like, why don't we, you know, see if we can move you somewhere else in the department, or, you know, you can stay on until you found another job. They really tried to work with me. But as I'm sitting there, they said, I was sort of given a choice, like, okay, well, you know, come in tomorrow, let us know what your decision is. And I kind of, they said, why don't you go home and think about it? I was like, well, no, I've got like work I kind of want to get done. You know, all the other good work we've been doing. But I ended up not getting a whole heck of a lot done because I was sitting there. And then I kind of realized like all that good work, you know, because part of that good work required us to collect a certain amount of data. And I suddenly realized like all of it was tainted now. Every thing we did was now tainted because it was now a tool to be used by this administration to hunt down and deport people who are just trying to survive. Like, I don't know if you know this, but it's a little rough right now.
yeah, I get, yes.
So, yeah, you know, these are just people, other human beings, you know, doing what we do, you know, going to work because
I mean, if you watch Trump talking about immigrants, undocumented immigrants, you would swear that they're all Spanish speaking Hitlers. But nothing could be further from the truth.
Well, it's like it's one of the weird things where like we have to have this idea that like they're perfect people. It's like they're people. Like, you know what? I'm pretty sure there are plenty of immigrants out there who are unpleasant people to be around generally. But like, there's plenty of people whose families have lived here, you know, back from when we stole all the land from the natives, like, you know, like who are also generally not pleasant to be around. So it's like, but these are just
right. I mean, people. and I that's, mean, that's the thing. What you did is you looked behind, you looked behind what Hannah Arendt once referred to as the banality of evil. And you saw human beings.
I have actually read that. Yeah, well, it's the thing of it is that, so I've been trying to sort of, as I've been dealing with this sudden level of attention I've received, I've been trying to figure out how to explain to people, like, because there's this thing where everyone's like, well, I mean, like, do you have, like, you know, do you know many immigrants? It's like, not really. I don't know many recent immigrants. I mean, I've predominantly grown up and lived in blisteringly white places. I grew up mostly in Maine, you know, went to college in Vermont. I live in Montana. These are fairly monochromatic places.
White. The word we're looking for is white. Yes.
White. Yes.
No, I understand all of that. And the fact that you, with this career behind you, and, you know, I was just thinking as you were talking about how your wife responded to it all, kind of makes sense. You said library science, right?
Yeah.
Yes. Yeah, see, librarians are, you know, I don't know about you, but I never planned on being an adult in a world where librarians were the subversive guardians of freedom.
It's wild, right? We're librarians, and the person running the dictionary Twitter account is like these are the people that are standing up for what. In every dystopian novel we've ever written, like, nobody pegged librarians as the...
No. No.
We've severely underestimated librarians.
I mean, in the great dystopian film Brazil, he's not a librarian, but it kind of makes sense that it would be the librarians, and I imagine your spouse is probably significantly into that understanding of the nature of the struggle. So I'm not surprised that someone like you, who is surrounded by the law, and someone like your spouse, who is surrounded by the threat on informational freedom, would come to this place. I read the Washington Post account of this, and someone higher up than you in the department said, it's our understanding his decision to resign is purely based on his personal opposition to the federal administration's rhetoric on immigration. Okay, and what else would it be?
Right? Like, I mean, it was.
Oh, we're sorry to announce that that he has morals, that he has a conscience. We don't understand where it came from.
Well, you know, that's another thing. Like, you know, I've been doing a lot of these all of a sudden, and I can't remember. Because at first I wasn't exactly sure what I wanted to tell people, like, about me. But people seem to have this thing where they wanted to understand, like, how could you possibly come to this decision? I mean, you know, again, like, you know, where do morals come from? Like, you know, I think that's a deeper philosophical question that, you know, maybe we, you know, people are trying to figure that out.
I'll be honest, I wasn't being honest before. But one of the things that I've been looking forward to our conversation. And last night on the air, I was telling this story about a legislator in Utah. And he got wind that the local paper was going to publish the stories about how he had on a couple of occasions. Of course, he's good. He's a good family values Republican, Utah, et cetera. And...
Okay, are we talking family values, or like that? Is that a code word for doesn't like gay people?
No, that's a code word for likes to hire hookers.
Oh, okay.
And that's what he had been doing on the state dime down in Utah, and when he got word of it, he went, "Oh, I think I hear my family calling me. I'd better resign from the legislature," and so he quit because he was about to be outed as a monumental
hypocrite. Yeah.
And what struck me is the massive amount of difference between a situation like that and a situation like yours, in which there's no reason you can't continue doing your job except for the fact that the behavior of the government in which we are all supposed to be the boss has become so odious as to become intolerable to anybody who has a functioning conscience.
You know, it's funny because, you know, to me, I've been trying to tell people, like, okay, this was a difficult decision in that, like, I was fully cognizant of what I was doing, that this would blow up the whole plan we had, possibly, you know, my stories are real, you know, rags to, like, bargain basement clothing story. So, like, I mean, money has never been a thing that I've had in abundance. So, but I had, you know, I had crawled up from, like, food insecure poor to, you know, paycheck to paycheck poor, which is, you know, it's an upgrade. It's still
well, as George W. Bush said a lot of years ago, that paycheck to paycheck poor, that's uniquely American now, isn't it? But I wanted to share something with you, Jordan. I have for many years now, I use as my signature line on my email a quote from Kurt Vonnegut that I have shared with the community that you're talking to now. But I don't think I've ever talked to anyone to whom, how can I say this? You embody what Vonnegut was trying to get across in the fact that you don't resemble what he describes. So what he said was, a normal person functioning well on the upper levels of a prosperous industrialized society can hardly hear his conscience at all. And somehow or another, Jordan, you managed to still the noises and the cacophony and the chaos around you enough that you heard your conscience and you heard the voices that were in your conscience. And I cannot express enough admiration for what you did. But you also did something, I mean, you're not a trust fund baby, as you've made obvious. But you had to be scared witless just stepping off into the moral universe like this.
Well, so I had a pretty chaotic childhood. And one of the things, like, children of abuse and neglect tend to be really good in chaos. It's when everything quiets down, when we sort of fall apart. So like, I was at peace with my decision. Had this not gotten the legs it had, I probably would have fallen apart in a couple days. Like, by now I would be a puddle on the floor. Like, what the hell did I do? Why did I do this to my family? Like, you know, over something as silly and insignificant as moral principles, you know, like, so, you know, and in part of that, you know, chaotic childhood, like, I abuse, neglect, never spent more than a full year in one school system. Like, stability was not a thing I have known until, like, my adult life, when I had the power to make my own decisions. So, like, when one of the things that towards the end of my adolescence, I, you know, clawed my way into finding, like, a stable family unit. My mom, the mom I found, she had a soft spot for strays. She took in stray cats and stray kids with, like, not a moment's hesitation. Just if you needed a place to be, hers was the place to be. And so, like, she had two kids by blood, but she had a lot of kids who were hers, because, you know, I just happened to be one of the people who ended up, like, living with them. Finding a family, finding some stability, finding people, where a place where you felt safe and loved, was kind of a big deal for me. And so this idea that I was going to mess that up for somebody else, no. I know what it's like to struggle to find a home. As part of that uniquely messed up childhood, I suffered from depression all my life. It took me a while to realize it was depression, because, like, when you long-term chronic depression, you sort of mistake it for a personality trait, not a mental illness.
The way the world works?
Yeah, just the way the world works. Everyone thinks about killing themselves all the time, don't they? Come on. I mean, if not, then, you know, I'm crazy. Oh, ding. I've struggled with suicidal thoughts. So like when I say that had I done this, I could not live with myself, like that's quite literally true.
Yeah, that's one not a that's that, yeah, that's not a statement of metaphor. That is a statement of existential fact.
But, yeah, like it would have been let's just pretend like I made that decision and didn't instantly fall into depression. The next time depression rolled around and I had to ask myself, like, no, I'm actually a good person, I've been like, no, you're kind of not. You sold out people. You're kind of not. And that would have been, an existential threat.
Well, it's certainly not the end of the story. Let's call it, so we won't say it's the happy ending. We'll say it's the happy intermission. You took this leap. You walked away.
Yeah.
You walked away from something that there are a whole lot of people in this country who don't have, and that is steady, reasonably full-time work. Having done that, though, you did so into an obviously fragile state. Your wife is finishing school. You've got an almost four-year-old toddler running around the house, and all of a sudden, You're a guy who doesn't have a job. Good things began to happen, though, when your story went out, didn't it?
Well, so here's the funny thing. So first thing I did after work was I picked up my wife and I went to go see my in-laws to tell them, because they live in town and they were actually watching the kid. So it's like, oh, I'm just coming here. No, we're not just coming up to pick up our child. I've got some news. I quit my job. I don't have a job lined up. And I explained to them, and it was kind of, things were a little muted. They supported my decision because they understood, like, there's a reason that
they raised a daughter who's going to be a librarian.
Like they knew what they were doing. So like, so I told them, and then I sent out the tweets, because part of my thing is I'm a lover of words, and so I sort of think with words. I use that as a way to, muddle through what I'd just done. And part of my love of words is I'd also been working on like a work in progress fiction thing on my computer, like sitting there, and as part of that, I had turned off all notifications on Twitter, like. So we have dinner. They invite us for dinner. And my phone's not buzzing because I've turned off notifications. All of them, I don't have the little badge app, badge on top that says how many notifications you have, or I don't have banners, nothing showing up on my phone. So it wasn't until somewhere between, like, we finish dinner, we're wrapping up, we pack up all our stuff, we get in the car. I sort of have to have this conversation with my four-year-old that, hey, like, things are going to change. Trying to explain this, toddlers are interesting creatures. They're sort of halfway there on understanding stuff. So I'm trying to explain, like, I had to make a difficult choice because I didn't want to break up families. And in that way, where occasionally, like, out of the mouth of babes, like this insight, why would anybody want to break up families? That's sad. Which kind of leveled me. Like I was like, I was pretty messed up right then. So somewhere between then and when we got home, like I, pull out my phone and something had happened somewhere in between sending that out and, this ride home about to put my kid to bed. Like, I had not expected this to become a thing because I had kind of given up hope that any of this mattered. Like beyond the personal decision that I was making for me and my family, I didn't think it mattered anymore. I mean, because like it feels like nothing. It felt like nothing mattered because we've been under this sort of administration with every new scandal, like new levels of awful that. Any one of these would have just wrecked any other presidency, but by sheer volume of scandal, nobody knows how to process it, so they just keep happening. And so, you know, stuff happens and nobody cares.
Right. And there's an element, and we've talked about it on this program, Jordan. By the way, I'm speaking with Jordan Dierdal Roberts, who recently walked away from his job at the Montana Department of Labor rather than break up families by collaborating with ICE. We've talked about on this program, Jordan, the fact that there's, on the one hand, Trump and his administration and all the hatreds and various bigotries and the very fine Klansmen and the very fine Nazis. But there's also a Republican structure out there that has thrived for years and years and years on similar hatreds. So it's not all Trump. There are people who are very, very happy to see what's going on now.
Trump is not a departure from Republican principles. He's coalesced those principles. It's just that the sort of basic, like in the same way where the veneer of civility is off of ICE, like he's there. I mean, people have used this a lot to describe him. He's the Republican id. Like there's no, like,
no filter.
Know, I mean, he gets to spout off about family values while, you know, he's multiple divorces, which, you know what, like, divorce is nothing bad, but like, if you're going to be the guy talking about family values and like,
if you've had three divorces, or if you've had two divorces and you're on your third marriage because you cheat on every spouse you had, that's a different kind of algebra. There are bad marriages, and people have to get out of them. Most marriages fail in this country over matters of money. His failed because of his, I don't know, infantile insecurities, where he constantly had to fool around and prop up his fading sense of sexual virility. Who knows? But the thing is, there is a group of people out there who are happy to let him do whatever it is he wants to do, as long as it helps them to achieve their overall goals.
You've got evangelicals who are standing behind him. Like, I love it. It's like, well, he's asked for forgiveness. It's like, one of those things about asking for forgiveness is like, you kind of actually have to like change the behavior you've asked for forgiveness for. Like, if you just keep doing it, then like, so, I mean, he's,
yeah, the I word mean, we're looking yeah, for is not, contrition, and there ain't none.
No. Well, I mean, I don't think he's never in his life had to face a consequence for any action he has done. You know, he's been insulated by money and being who he is. I mean, he's never had, you know, everything he's done, there's always been a cushion for him. So there's no reason for him to ever alter his behavior, and the Republican Party right now is they're letting him just do his thing because, oh hey, finally we get to, you know, really put in the tax cuts and get rid of anything that's going to help anybody, yay.
So you saw your initial tweet. I think the first one was seriously. It was very simple. Almost Zen kind of tweet. Your first tweet was, seriously, fuck ICE.
You know, like, I sent that out right when I first realized that, yeah, I was going to have to handle subpoenas. Like I said, I used Twitter as a bit of therapy, thinking my way through my words. Like, yeah, that was... And then...
Then you sort of expanded on what that meant and what that was in your particular situation. And then people figured out through what you were saying that you had just put your own existence at hazard for the sake of defenseless people. And knowing that you were essentially broke, and that you were jobless, and that you couldn't file for unemployment because you were a voluntary quit, one's conscience does not, the unemployment compensation scheme does not account for consciences. Some weirdo evangelical right-wing phony baloney Christian pharmacist can say, my conscience prevents me from letting you have your slut medicine, lady, and he gets to keep his job. You had to quit yours. And as a consequence,
unfortunately, I'm just an atheist, so I couldn't have like said, oh, and like not like it's understood that I was an atheist, so I couldn't have just said, oh no, Jesus had said we have to love our neighbor, and this would not be loving our neighbor. Like I was out of any option to like couch this in anything other than just a moral objection.
Right, and so consequently, you're out of a job, you're broke. And all of a sudden, people began rallying. Yeah, something happened, and people began rallying to your cause. Was that and they did so, if I understand, quite astonishingly and surprisingly. Was it in fact a surprise for you?
Like I said, I thought. I didn't think that necessarily like nobody cared, but I sort of thought the caring was not in sufficient numbers to matter. Like that we were, that American democracy was circling the drain. I was surprised because like when this all started, I had about 1,000 followers on Twitter, little over. And I've been on there for like 9 years now, and I had gone viral a couple times before for like snarky comments because like jokes take off really well on Twitter.
Oh yes,
but like devastating life circumstances, not so much. So that this had somehow struck a particular chord. When a tweet takes off like that, it's hard to figure out like the initial chain of like who first retweeted it in such a way that it takes off. So I have no clue who the first major retweet was. So to whoever that was, if they're out there listening, like, thank you. But it like I had not. Had I anticipated this, had I had a plan for this, I would have had a different profile picture up on Twitter. I might have had a slightly less jokey display name at first. It was for a while. I don't know if it's still floating around on some of the articles, but the thing I had as my profile picture was a shirt that I had as a quote unquote Halloween costume. It said "Sexy Dawning Realization That Nothing Will Ever Be Okay." Like, you know, while you appreciated the zen of my fuck ice tweet, I might have gone a little bit more PG-13, kept it, like damn them something,
Yeah, exactly.
I had sent that out there, like I said, as therapy and sort of hoping that I the people who I'd been on there with for years and formed friendships with, like that they would be like, hey man, like, you did the right thing, or, the small little circle of friends who I talk to pretty regularly, like there's dad Twitter, there's mental health Twitter, there's really frustrated with the political situation Twitter, like, but these were little circles that I had. And it went off. And what was even like, I wake up Thursday, I had trouble sleeping that night. Cause like my heart was just hammering in my chest. Cause I was having all these conflicting emotions. Cause like I said, I'd kind of given up on this country. Like we were done. We were toast. That's it. Make sure you turn out the lights so long.
Exactly. And so people responded. You heard from dreamers. You heard from people who said that you may very well have saved a life. And you yourself, you said, you hoped that you had maybe bought a few more days before some family gets shattered into a million tiny pieces.
Earlier, I was speaking with somebody else who was for a story they were doing, and they had said that they had spoken that the subpoena had already been processed by now. Like, so I'm guessing either yesterday or today it was sent out. Now, had this not taken off, I mean, maybe since it took off, those people not like the people in Montana who might be in trouble right now, at least. Maybe, hopefully, they've got a heads up that, like, ICE is at the door, because, you know, I people understood ICE is going around and doing stuff, but I don't necessarily think everybody understood how they were tracking people down. Because,
well,
you know,
and that's the thing. Let me go back to just for a minute, if I may, Jordan. Let me go back to some of the more nuts and boltsier parts of this. What kind of data were they after with this subpoena?
Well, so like I said, I tapped out before the subpoena came in. But I mean, the thing of it is that for something like the Department of Labor to function, it collects data to, you know, like wages, you know, because how do you enforce fair wages if you don't have the data on the wages? And to get the data on the wages, you kind of have to have this information of who's getting paid what. So there's a lot of information there that, when used responsibly, is fairly benign. Because I mean, but so I don't know exactly what piece of information they were looking for, but I mean, they're are, you know, how wide a net they were trying to cast. But like right now, given that, like, if it's a court ordered subpoena, the department is legally obligated to comply. Now, myself as a private citizen, I had a moral obligation not to, but the department as a whole entity, unless there's some dramatic shift in, you know, somewhere in some hall of power, if it's come from a court and, you know, they've dotted their I's and crossed their T's and all that, they have to hand over the information. So it's, you know, I don't know exactly what it
right.
was, but
because we have enshrined our bigotry into law. They have to comply with the law.
Yeah, and I mean, usually the stuff, like, it was like if somebody was having a wage dispute with their former employer, like somebody would subpoena to, like, either side would subpoena to get the wage information, you know, that was tracked as, like, a, you know, we need this for the case, which was like, okay, that's cool, that's a perfectly valid reason, totally in line with the basic functions of the department. But what ICE has done is they've taken I'm fairly certain they're not just looking at the Department of Labor. So what they've done is they've turned every state agency into part of that machine. So,
well, agencies, beyond elements of government, we know now that ICE stalks churches. Now, you recently, or just a little bit ago, you said, you know, you're only an atheist. That's a phrase for the ages. And, you know, I tell people I'm a recovering Southern Baptist, or I say that I'm a Frisbee.
Oh,
I'm a Frisbeterian, and we believe when you die, your soul goes up on the roof and you can't get it down, things like that.
I've been in a couple Southern Baptist churches, so I get your... No.
Yeah, you're never well. You're constantly... It's not a 12... Being a recovering Southern Baptist isn't a 12-step program. It's like infinite steps. It's just every day you have to decide you're not going to be as nasty as the Southern Baptists are. But anyway...
Well, you know,
having said that...
I was going to say...
Oh, go ahead, please. Yeah.
Well, I was going to say, like, I mean, I was originally raised Catholic, so, I, you know, the Catholic guilt, that's the thing. Like, you never get over Catholic guilt. Like, that's with you for forever.
Well, exactly, and it'll hover in the background. But what I was moving toward is that there are, you know, there are churches out there that, despite how I feel about organized religion, which is not a nice thing, I'm not inclined to, but there are churches that are actually trying to fulfill the message as they understand it. And that includes not crapping on the on the poorest and most fragile and most most easily harmed among us. And to that
That's
end,
you have done unto the least of my brethren.
I love it how atheists can. I love it how atheists can quote the Bible better than believers can. Yeah,
you know what? One of the people who I used to work with had said, you know, nothing annoys people more than a liberal who's read the Bible.
Yeah, that's the absolute truth. But you know, I'm sure you don't sound like the kind of person who walks around. But you just did. You just did something that in former eras they have built monuments to people who do it.
So here's the thing. While I'm not necessarily emotionally equipped for people to call me an inspiration, there's a thing that's happening right now that I'm a little uncomfortable with because, there's problems with the word hero. As part of my love of words, like I tend to analyze the crap out of every narrative. And one of the things that the college I went to, Marlboro College, not affiliated with the cigarettes. Everyone makes that joke. Please don't do it. Marlboro, Vermont, it's this little tiny liberal arts college. They sort of let you, they have this, at your end of your college career, you have this thing called your plan. It's like you get to craft over the last 2 years and decide what you want to like focus your stuff on. I focused on the idea of the hero in American culture. And so one of the conclusions I came to is that there's a problem with heroes in that when people are looking for a hero, part of what they do is they sacrifice some of their own agency and their ability to act. Have you ever done CPR training?
Say again, please, what kind of training?
CPR.
Oh, yes, CPR, absolutely, I have.
Yeah, so one of the things that they teach you is that, like, when you start, like, before you start doing the CPR, like, you got to point to somebody and say, you go call 911, because the more people standing around you, the less likely people are to act, because let's say you have 30 people standing in a circle around somebody on the ground dying. Everyone is thinking, well, someone's going to call 911. I don't have to, because somebody else is going to do it. And that's kind of what happens when people start talking about heroes. It's that, well, somebody's going to do it, so I don't have to.
Right. So everybody stands around waiting for somebody else to do something. I know a little bit about that. And
yeah.
So, and you know, you're right. We've got a thing I talk about here. It's a phrase that comes from a wonderful book called Aztec by Gary Jennings, and the protagonist in the book talks about the years he spent becoming a practitioner of the art of word knowing. And so we talk about the art of word knowing around here. And you're right.
I like that.
You're absolutely right. Hero is a freighted phrase because in the classical sense of the word, which is where we get the idea of a hero from in the first place, heroes are deeply flawed people who often do awful things.
Awful things, yeah. But I have read my Iliad and my Odyssey. Yeah,
see, okay, just, then yeah, you know then.
Yeah, the heroes of old weren't the heroes we sort of have now, which is, again, like when I was, you know, talking about heroes in American culture, like that's one of the major shifts in the way we talked about them, was we sort of tried to move them into this idea of like, these were, you know, above average people who do great things. And but it's, you know, it's what we need right now is we don't need heroes. We need everybody. I mean, like, seriously, and this is a knock on myself, but like, I'm a nobody. Like, I'm just some dude living in Montana trying to get by. Like, I am not some great example of, you know, of what it means to be an, like, a human. I have a lot of frailties. I have a lot of faults. And so when people start tossing around that word hero, the thing I worry about is that, you know, it's going to be like, okay, somebody's going to, like, one is that somebody's going to, the idea that somebody's going to save us so we can sit back and let somebody else do it. And then also that, like, hero, like, when people start turning heroes into symbols, symbols can get corrupted. So, like, you know, like, somebody's going to, like, I didn't come to this, like, fully formed. So, like, I've occasionally been an arrogant, ignorant jackass.
Well, wait a minute, Here, since we already admit that we know their Bible better than they do, here, let me throw one out for you before you jump up on the cross and start driving the nails in, Jordan. For all have sinned and come short of the glory of God, okay? So now that we've gotten that out of the way...
But it's that... It's
yeah,
that
welcome to being human.
Have you heard the phrase milkshake duck?
I saw that, and you're a little younger than me, and I'm kind of a geezer who yells at clouds. So can you help me with that, please? What is milkshake duck?
Yeah, so milkshake duck, and I wish I could remember the original person who sent it out, but it was they sort of, again, in that way where Twitter, like, takes on to jokes really well, more than, like, you know, tragedies, but it describes a phenomenon where it said, oh, hey, here's this adorable picture of a duck drinking a milkshake, and then next week, we regret to inform you that the milkshake drinking duck is racist. So it's that.
Oh, that makes perfect sense. Okay, thank you so much. No, really. So today, you're going to love this. I mean, we're veering away from the topic, but I think this we're having a conversation now.
It feels pretty good.
How are the in-laws? Oh, good. Well, okay, so today I'm on Twitter. And I found out, what a surprise, that, golly Moses, the New York Times just hired a Nazi sympathizer for their opinion page. You know, and this isn't like Twitter style, oh, you're a Nazi, oh, you're a Klansman, you know, because it gets thrown around quite a bit. No, the New York Times just hired as a writer on their opinion page a real live, no kidding, Nazi sympathizer. And so I'm scrolling and I see the phrase milkshake duck. And 55-year-old geezer that I am, I went, the fuck is milkshake duck? And because the goddess of irony is the only real goddess in the universe, and the only way you can appease her is to sacrifice whoopee cushions and rubber chickens at midnight under a new moon, I get you tonight, Jordan, to explain milkshake duck to me in the context of a broader conversation about an act of sublime human decency that you performed in not being a milkshake duck.
Well, so you know what's really screwed up about the whole Nazi thing right now is, so there was this definite. Here's another one I got to throw at you. So have you ever heard of Godwin's Law?
Oh, I'm all over Godwin's Law. We pretty much beat the stuffings out of that here. Godwin's Law has been disproved.
Well, it's so, but like for the audience, if they don't know that idea of, like, you know, any discussion on the internet, the longer it goes on, the chances of someone being compared to Hitler or the Nazis approaches one. So, like, any conversation long enough, somebody's going to call someone a Nazi. But the thing of it is about that law of the internet, it talks about the chances of it happening, not the accuracy of the statement.
Ta-da!
So like, we're at this point in history now where, because I think it's partly because of that, and also because we've kind of treated Nazis like cartoon supervillains in video games and movies. I mean, they're the bad guys you can just sort of kill and not feel guilty about in all sorts of video games and TV shows and all that stuff. It's like, oh, well, they're Nazis. But it's made them a bit sort of like cartoonishly evil. So now as we've arrived in this fairly unique point in history, when, you know, there's some actual fairly stark, uncomfortable historical parallels we're facing right now, the need to be able to say, like, you know, this is ringing of Nazi Germany, it's needed, but because the word Nazi has been thrown around so much for things that aren't anything, like, you know, things people have called things that are bad, like things that have been legitimately bad Nazis, but there's Nazi bad is kind of its own special flavor of bad.
Yeah, I was carrying on a conversation the other day, and the line came up, and I looked up and I said, look, only Hitler can be Hitler. Okay, Donald Trump can't be Hitler. Donald Trump has to be Donald Trump, and he may wind up worse than, it's possible, okay? But only Hitler can be Hitler, only Stalin can be Stalin, only Pol Pot can be Pol Pot, only Genghis Khan can be Genghis Khan. But here's the thing. Godwin's law does not apply to real, live, goose-stepping Nazis.
Jeez, yeah. Yeah, and, you know, it's like, and we've reached this point where, like, I mean, we had Charlottesville, we had, like, I mean, they've changed the uniform now, it's white pants and khakis and red hats, but, like, you know, because
that's their summer wardrobe, Jordan. They've been wearing those. They've been wearing those since the 1920s.
But it's like, it's this thing where, yeah, like we're in this point where, and like you can sit there and say, you know, they're Nazis, and because we've overused it, everyone's like, oh, well, you just call everyone Nazis. Like, no, like hand up in the air, you know, Nazi salute, like blood and soil. Have to take in decoding dog whistle, because people get to say certain things that are like, if you understand the context, well, you know, like milkshake duck, but milkshake duck is not a, you know, it's not like a Nazi code word, but like in that, you know, there's phrases used that mean very specific things in a specific set of circumstances, and when you have them chanting and digging up these things, like, they essentially what they've done, they've sort of, so because I have the misfortune of, like, reading way too much, like, I understand where some of these things come from in the deep bowels of the internet, where essentially what they've done is if you're aware that they're coming, there's you, there's the Nazis, and then there's everyone else who gets called the normies, and they have, because they have their little code language, they can sort of trick the normies into thinking that they're not, like, legitimately talking about, like, you know, trying to finish Hitler's work. Like, we have a very, you know, these aren't, while the rest of us definitely outnumber them, there's an uncomfortable number of Nazis kicking around right now, and they feel pretty emboldened.
Oh, they're excited. As the song goes, the future belongs to them, or so they think. And one of the overarching themes here, and I know you're not particularly familiar with what we do here, but that's okay. One of the overarching themes here, Jordan, is that the vast majority of Americans do not understand how many Nazis, how many Klansmen, and how many people who would gladly enable them and sympathize with them there are in this country right now. And something you may not know, I'm sure since you're a lot more plugged in, you know who Milo is, Milo, whatever.
Oh yeah.
Okay,
yeah,
so you know him, you know who Steve Bannon is. Well, back before the 2016 election, they took to the air on the little radio program that's run by that website that rhymes with light and fart, and they said more than half of the GOP base is alt-right. That's a quote, Jordan. And what I've begged people is, if you do not believe me when I say that the Republican Party is filthy with Nazis and Klansmen, will you at least believe them?
Well, again, I love, like, alt-right, like, I mean, it's like, you know, there's this idea that they're kind of like diet Nazis, like, you know, the Diet Coke of Nazis. Like, it's they're slightly less Nazi light.
More goose stepping, less ovens. Right. No.
Yeah. Well, it's funny. You also have, because of the way, you know, the internet works with, and like, so there's these people who sort of like think it's a joke. Like, and so German is a wonderful language. They have like a word for everything. So we have, they have Nazis, but do you want to know what they call the ironic Nazi, the guy who was just there for the lulz?
I didn't know there was such a word, but if there is, they've got one. Yeah, I actually would, because I love German.
Yeah, Nazi.
Oh, wait a minute. We have this thing we do here. When somebody says something funny in conversation, they get a cowbell. You just got a cowbell, Jordan.
Oh, well, thank you. No, it's one of these things where people are like, oh, well, you know, they're just kids being kids. It's like, we have people who are sending death threats. Like, they find out somebody's Jewish on Twitter, they send them death threats, they send them memes of people being shoved into ovens, and it's like, oh, it's all, you know, it's just kids being kids. Like, no, like, at what point do we say no to that? Like, at what point do we put our foot down and say, no, this is...
Yeah, see, there's a parallel version of what you just said about the German joke there. A father and son are out talking one day, and they see that a bird has come by and splattered the car windshield with some bird shit. And there's all that white, and then there's a little black speck in the middle of the bird shit. And the dad, you know, passing on the imparting the wisdom of the ages to his son, says, son, you know what that little black speck is in the middle of the bird shit? And the boy says, no, Dad, I don't. What is the little black speck in the middle of the bird shit? And Dad looks at him gravely and says, son, that's bird shit, too. You know, Nazis is Nazis is Nazis is Nazis, to overwork poor Gertrude Stein. But it's a fact.
Well, and that's the thing. It's like they and because they have sort of taken over and put in power, like, that's how they've turned. ICE was never my favorite part of the government.
I didn't like them under Obama, and I didn't like them under W. So, you know, I come by it honest.
Yeah. It's, but like right now, like, I mean, they're emboldened by these policies, because the policy right now is, well, and it's funny, because people have been like, well, the Polish doctor was white. I'm like, you guys don't understand how Nazis feel about the Poles, do you? they don't think Polish people are white. Like, It's
a fair question, like, and I think you're verging on asking it, Jordan. It's a fair question to ask with regard to just about any law enforcement agency, and certainly ICE. How many Nazis, how many Klansmen, how many white supremacists, how many alt-right, how many white nationalists, whatever we care to call this human waste, how many of them are in
law enforcement agencies? That was the plan. Like, they took off the hoods and they put on badges. Like, they evolved. I mean, they didn't, you know, evolve any sort of, you know, humanity, but they've changed their tactic to sort of, I mean, this is the thing where I've occasionally been called an alarmist, and like my dream of dreams is like, we get through this and I'm still considered an alarmist. Like, that, you know, all the things that I think could horribly go wrong that I thought was sort of going wrong right from when he started his whole campaign saying all Mexicans are rapists, that should have been it, but it wasn't. And the rhetoric starting that scapegoating and others saying, oh, we've got, you know, these Muslims and these immigrants, they're the reason, you know, you don't have a job. It's like, this again, that uncomfortable historical parallel, you know, we have sort of ceded certain ground to them at this point by letting them. Yeah, it's like, oh, well, you know, and the thing of it is that, like, people do this thing where they say, oh, well, I'm sorry to all the Jeffs in the audience, but I'm going to choose Jeff as a, like, it's like, oh, but Jeff's a nice guy. You know, he comes down to the barbecue. It's like, so, I mean, of course, Jeff can't be a Nazi. It's like, there's this thing where like people assume that because somebody has, you know, a good facade, that there's not like monster's not a good word here, because what one of the things, another one of the things with words like monster is that people tend to think, oh, well, like the monsters are obvious, and that like, oh, well, you have to acknowledge people's humanity. Like humanity is, you know, like humans have done some pretty awful things to each other throughout history. So the idea that like, oh, but he's just a human, it's like that's kind of a value neutral judgment. Like, okay, he's a human, but what he does with that humanity is a different thing. So this idea that like, you know, Officer Jeff's a nice guy to me. So, I mean, obviously he's not, you know, a white supremacist. It's like, well, no, you can seem like a nice guy. Like this idea that the monsters are going to be that obvious that they're going to, I mean.
No. And you sound like the kind of person who would, who might have a taste for old Twilight Zone episodes. There's a very famous, there's a very famous Twilight Zone episode titled simply "The Monsters Are Due on Maple Street." And whenever I hear that word monster in the context of a conversation like this, Jordan, I think immediately of that episode, because it's the Twilight Zone. So, you know, there's going to be a snap ending, but it doesn't take an abacus to figure out who the monsters on Maple Street probably are from jump.
Well, and it's one of those things where again, using the phrase they tend to use, the normies out there, they just think that, you know, I mean, it's so because I understand the cops aren't always the good guys. It's a wild concept to some folks. It's a little weird to watch, like right now I have a kid, and it's kind of hard to find kids media that's even willing to acknowledge that, like, maybe the cops aren't always have your best interest at heart. So it's like you watch, so I can see how people can arrive at that idea that, like, well, I mean, because
you've got a world that's opening up to you, Jordan, because unless something happens, you win the lottery or become fabulously wealthy day after tomorrow or something, you're gonna raise your little white kid in a certain world, and my wife and I have raised four here, but I'm in Appalachia, okay, one of the poorest places in the country, and I cannot begin to even remotely not comprehend, but I can't say that I understand what families of color go through when they have to have the talk, and we know what the talk is with their kids.
But there is
a different kind of talk that not vastly wealthy white folks have to have with their kids too, because there are bad things that can happen to them.
So I don't want this to be a sob story, but I do want people to understand where I'm coming from. So, my uniquely torturous childhood, the mother that I was with, who, that's a whole other thing, but she was trying to get into law enforcement. The boyfriend that liked to beat the hell out of me and my brother was a former cop. So like, when like Black Lives Matter first became this movement, this thing, and there was all these people like sort of shocked that, you know, cell phones came out and all of a sudden all the UFOs disappeared and all the cops turned out to be brutal. Like people were like shocked by like this idea that cops could be, you know, bad people. It's like, hi. I was clued into that one fairly young, like that, you know, the cops, I mean, if you look at the domestic violence rate amongst cops, it's higher than the average. So this idea that law enforcement is always going to be on your side was a thing I was, that was a notion I was disabused of at a very young age. So, you know, this idea that, yeah, like people just kind of want to trust cops. And now that the white supremacists have done a fairly good job of, you know, infiltrating that, like, and they I'm like, so do you remember, I don't know if you saw it, a little while back, there was a video that was released of the Border Patrol agents kicking
over the water? Yes.
There's humanitarian groups who like leave water in the desert.
Yes.
So the Border Patrol agents, like, they kick it over, they dump it. And the people who are leaving the water there are leaving it there so that people don't die of thirst.
Yes.
That seems like, you know, so, and I saw that video and there was one guy who was like, there's a couple of the shots of the video that they obviously didn't know they were being filmed, but there's one with like the person who's filming this dude is standing right in front of him. And he's got this smile on his face as he's dumping out the water. Like, I mean, this was a man who was enjoying his job a little too much. Like, this wasn't like, this is my job, this is what I have to do to feed my family. It's like, I'm knowingly condemning people to die. It's not like, you know, they weren't standing at the border like they were going to turn them back when they got there. They were going, well, we're going to make sure that there are some bleached bones in this desert of people who will die because we are dumping this water out knowing, like, you'd have to be a special kind of ignorant to not understand what you were doing in that moment. And so, I want people to, if people can sort of, like, stop for a second and try to understand, like, can you imagine how crappy your life has to be in a country where right now you would still try to get into America? Like,
yeah, see, that's why the Norwegians aren't coming.
Oh, man. So it was kind of wild. I think it might have been because of the Dyrdal name, but I got, like, contacted from a Norwegian journalist. And they did a story, of course, I mean, Google Translate has been failing me greatly right now because
that's what it was designed to do, but never mind. Yeah.
Yeah. But, you know, like, I'm monolingual. That's my fault. I could have tried a little harder to retain some of that, you know, foreign language learning. But so, like, I can't, there are articles being written about me that I can't fully read. But yeah, when I'm getting coverage in Norway, I'm going, like, was it just the Dyrdal name? Because that's a Norwegian thing, or is it, you know, like, when Trump said, oh, why can't we have more people come in from Norway? I'm like, so the thing about Norway, it's an interesting phenomenon you see in places like that where, because I mean, it gets mighty cold in Norway, like, will kill you cold. And so they as a society kind of form this thing of like, well, we got to work together or we're not going to make it. And so, like, I mean, it's a country with, like, you know, socialized medicine and like paternity, parental leave and all this stuff. And Trump to say, well, why can't we get more people from Norway? I'm like, why would they leave Norway to come here? Like, you're not going to leave behind a really great place like that to come into Donald Trump's America where, you know, things are bad.
No, exactly. Well, Jordan, I am intensely grateful for the time that you have shared. And I know for a fact that one of the things you didn't say, because you will, I've learned in this last hour that you will absolutely not blow your own horn, so I'm going to have to do it for you. The fact of the matter is, a lot of people did reach out and did help you, but
yes.
But as soon as you knew that you had enough of a cushion to get by till you find the next job, you started giving the money away, Jordan.
I've been struggling with some technical issues, but I told people like the PayPal, like, there was money, and I was like, okay, like, you can start, like, if you want to direct that money. I was like, I mean, like, Flint still doesn't have water. I mean, Puerto Rico is, you know, has been abandoned. You know, I was like, there's a couple. I put some hashtags on there. There's a Show Up for Wishes is this really nice person on Twitter started this hashtag as a way for people to, like, just help each other out. Give me 1 second because I want to pull up the Twitter handle so that that credit can be given where it is due. It's at show up for this. And so this show up for wishes hashtag, she set it up so that if there was a need you had, you put your need out there, and then other people could, if you either send money or so before this happened, my wife had needed new boots because her winter boots right before winter, like, just fell apart, absolutely came apart. She was going to need new boots for winter, and, well, money was tight. And so she put it out there, and someone on Twitter sent her boots, sent her a nice pair of winter boots.
Like, wow.
So I was trying to, the show up for this goes by on Twitter, Jin, like, good people, like, good egg, like, seriously, one of the people who, like, you know, even when I was pretty sure, like, our country was down, I was like, well, okay, you know, there's people like Jin out there still, like, trying their best to keep us afloat. But, and
right, the wheels are wobbling, but we're trying to keep them on the axles. Yes.
Yeah. Well, and so it was even more wild. So, do you remember Julie Briskman?
Yes.
I don't know. Yeah, she got fired for flipping off Trump.
Yeah.
So she ended up setting up a GoFundMe page for me. Like, and the story is kind of funny. So, Deardall's not a super common name. There aren't that many out there.
No, fine Irish name. So, yes.
Yeah, fine Irish name. Julie had a history in journalism, so she, like, you know, used her, you know, detective skills and sleuthed out, and she ends up tracking down my mother-in-law's phone number, calling her up and being like, so, you know, do you know Jordan? Why, yes. And so she set up this GoFundMe page for me, and it's just, I constantly humbled by the support and the messages. And now what people have done is, before I was going to be scrambling to pick the next job that would give me money in exchange for my time. The support I've received has given me breathing room in such a way that instead of immediately searching for the next job, I now sort of feel that I have a responsibility to do something with this. I'm still trying to figure out what that is. Life's been a little bit of a whirlwind, but, like,
you don't want to run off to Silicon Valley and write code for Sergey Brin? Sorry, I'm being a bit of a smartass there. I apologize.
Well, I'm well versed in smartassery, so I'm. But it's, you know, I mean, it's, while I appreciate the vote of confidence, I have people who are telling me, like, you should run for office. I'm like, while I am political, I'm not politic. And there are people who have devoted much more of their life to, like, understanding how policy stuff works than I. And also, I mean, I do come from the state that not only voted for the guy who attacked a journalist, but has done so with a certain amount of pride.
Oh, like, Jordan, you're talking to Jordan. You're talking to a guy who lives in the Trumpiest place on earth. Okay, so
it's a special kind of hell. Like
I go to the grocery store. The checkout, the person at the checkout says, "I just love our President Trump, don't you?" You know, because I'm all white and everything, and she's all white and everything, and I'm like, no, I hate his freaking guts. Why?
So I have a problem in that I have no poker face. Like, I cannot hide an emotional reaction I have. It is a skill I do not possess. it keeps me honest. but like, so yeah, when like stuff happens like that, like people's face gets hard because I must be looking at them like, what the hell are you talking about? Because yeah, like, so it's, you know, there's a reason I'm not, you know, well, there are a lot of reasons I'm not a social butterfly, but that one helps. It's like, and it, now granted, I have had quite a few people in Montana reach out to me and being like, you know, just bump up solidarity, like we're out here. Like it's not all the same sort of people. But
and
like,
there's a tremendous value in that. When the self-imposed sense of isolation is broken, and you find out how many people are out there that share your feelings, that share your thoughts.
That helps a lot. Like I seriously, like I said, the response has been humbling. It's been uplifting to find, yeah, all these people like saying, oh man, I especially after the Gianforte win, there were a lot of us who were just kind of downtrodden. So it's been nice to like connect with a lot of these people and like, hey, you know,
I'll tell you what my thumbnail impression is based on our little conversation here, Jordan. I think your gut reaction to not being a politician is probably a good reaction. I just don't hear Jordan sitting in some state house or the Capitol saying, my good friend over there who wants to take away a woman's right to choose. Now, your sense of comic hypocrisy has not yet advanced that far. You'd be halfway across the table with a broken beer bottle, I suspect.
You know, that's like I said. I'm political. I'm not politic.
Exactly.
I will
say that you sound like a person whose future is begging to be intimately connected to doing real good for real human beings.
I thank you. I hope so. Like at this point, like when I just did this as a personal decision for me and my family, I thought that was it. But now that this has become a thing, like, yeah, I feel like I have a responsibility to do something with it. I'm like I said, still trying to figure out what that something is, trying to figure out where I want to go with this, what that job is going to be that's going to let me continue this. Like, I mean, whether that's working in some immigration law office, you know, I law wasn't my passion, but I've been doing this long enough that I've, you know, developed a certain set of skills that would help.
And you might be able to trot it right into 1L at the University of Busted Knuckle there in or wherever in Montana, and the next thing you know, you might be walking around with a funny wig on your head or something. You never can tell.
Who knows? But like, I mean, there's
that was chilling.
It might
wasn't
be journal. That caused a uncomfortable feeling in the pit of my stomach. But like journalism might be a thing. Like I don't know right now. And right now I'm just trying to like, while I have this 15 minutes, I want to jump up and down and scream everything is on fire to like get people to realize like everything is on fire right now. And that the nobodies out there, the little people just doing their job who were, you know, in positions like mine, where you're asked to just become part of this machine while I apparently have some attention, it's time.
Yeah,
for
you didn't,
to,
you didn't
like,
throw
step
your,
up.
You didn't throw yourself on the gears. You walked away from the machine. And what you've done, Jordan, if I may be so bold as to suggest it, is something that, again, we've talked about from time to time here. You know, when they get 100,000 people in Washington, D.C., usually it happens on a Saturday, and it's over by Sunday, and everybody goes home because nobody can commit to a long-term protest or like a Velvet Revolution sort of sit-in where we get a 500,000 people surrounding the White House and the Capitol who say, you know, we'll leave when Trump does. We can't do that because people have mortgages and power bills and car payments and insurance and toddlers to feed.
It's almost like this perpetual poverty thing that, you know, Republican policies put people in is, you know, working out in their favor, you know, almost like it's a strategy. It's, yeah, like people have these worries. And that the thing of it is that, like I said, we are at a unique point in history where people really need to make a choice. What are they going to do? Are you willing to be part of this machine? And if you're not, you have to say no. And granted, when I said no, I didn't realize it was going to echo the way it did. But like, if you have an opportunity right now, like now's the time to do it. Cause apparently these things have legs right now. We've got to show that we're not going to just let them keep doing this. I understand the impulse that people are really, really hoping that like November 2018 midterms elections turn this around. There's this huge blue wave. We get Trump so locked up legislatively he can't accomplish anything. He, you know, whether or not he gets impeached or just like serves out the rest of his term as a, you know, useless figurehead of a nation, like that would be great. That would be really awesome. And again, I hope that we make it all through this. And I'm just sound like an alarmist at the end. But I mean, you saw what happened with Roy Moore, right?
Oh, sure. Actually, I was born and raised in Alabama, so I followed that pretty closely.
They went pretty hard and heavy on that voter suppression, and they lost by quite a bit, but not a lot. The margin there, like, so I'm fairly certain this coming election, they're going to go all in on that stuff. And what that's going to mean is, well, white people are really going to have to step up and be willing to, like,
those of us who can have got to disavow the assholes. Let's just put it that way.
Yeah. And when it comes to, like, getting to the polls, You've got to show up and get people to the polls. If that means putting yourself between them and whatever police officers they decide to put outside the polls to be intimidating, like that's what you got to do.
Well, it is. And look, the Trumpanzees are not going to stop being Trumpanzees. Tigers don't change their stripes and neither do skunks. Okay. And by the way, I have that for later. Yeah, save that. Use it in good health. While we were talking, I ran over and I followed you on Twitter, so I'll see you in my feed. I wish you, Jordan, the absolute best in life. I hope we'll have another conversation someday. I hope you'll continue to have your conversations with other people's as with other people. As ironic as it might sound, yours is a message that needs to be heard, and I mean, this sounds nuts. Yours is a message that needs to be heard in the churches that are trying to do the right thing by the immigrant population of the United States, because in many ways, they're on the forefront of this struggle. They need to invite you into their pulpits to tell them, you know, this is how you do it.
Those people are doing good work. So yeah, but thank you for helping me get this out. Cause like I said, I mean, people have got to do something, and pop me a message so I know where you are on the Twitter. Cause I meant things are a little wild there still.
Okay.
But I'd like to follow you back.
It's real easy. It's just Bob Kincaid. I'm just at Bob Kincaid.
Well, that's simple enough. I can manage that. thank you so much.
And you know what? Let me just tell you that if you catch yourself feeling like you're going to boil over or something, or you know, you just need to, I don't know, hoot like a barn owl or something, this is not, like I said, this is not our last conversation. You can call the program anytime you want to and rouse the troops. So, you know, please feel like you have a new friend. I feel like I do. And you've got a whole bunch of new friends in the Horn Family Community Congregation, Jordan.
All right. Thank you.
And hey,
so much. And
my absolute best, to your, I've already decided, wonderful wife and your, decidedly magic little toddler who from out of the mouths of babes come truths that adults often find hard to express. Why would anyone want to break up families? Man, that busted me. That flat busted me. So
yeah, same. So
Jordan right. Erdahl Roberts, thank you again, and have a lovely evening out there under the big sky.
Thank you so much.
Bye now.
Bye.
Jordan Erdahl Roberts, who refuses and rejects the idea of hero, even while he's busy being one. We are at 25 minutes before the third hour of the program. I love conversations like that. I do. And if you want to talk about it, you're mighty welcome to. It's also Titanic Tuesday, which means that there's a stack of those kinds of people. And so, yeah, let's take a break and see which way the program's going to go. It's a Tuesday, so that means that we have the Green News Report from Brad Friedman and Desi Doyen. And Ron and Raleigh and I established, like, some brainwaves or something, and we knew exactly what the bumper had to be. This is listener-supported conversation radio. This is The Horn. I'm Bob Kincaid.
We don't need to know the way home. It's Tuesday, February 13, 2018.
This morning I submitted legislative principles to Congress that will spur the biggest and boldest infrastructure investment in American history.
Trump's infrastructure proposal scam shifts costs onto states and cities and guts clean water and clean air regulations. Puerto Rico suffers a new blackout. Sea level rise is accelerating. Plus, Tesla and South Australia team up to build the world's largest virtual power plant.
Virtual power plant?
Virtual power plant.
All of those stories and more straight ahead. From BradBlog.com, I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
Stand by for 6 minutes of independent green news, politics, analysis, and snarky comment.
Did you watch this speech? He mentioned all the floods, you know, the wildfires, the storms we've had. Never once linked them to climate change. Yes, probably the work of the deep state, wouldn't you imagine?
I knew it. This is your Green News Report.
I'm gonna soak up the sun.
Okay, Desi Doyen. The scams never seem to end with this Trump administration.
No, they don't. On Monday, the Trump administration finally released what the administration and the media are misleadingly calling a $1.5 trillion proposal to repair the nation's crumbling infrastructure. But in reality, it is just a paltry $200 billion that will be cut from other crucial programs.
And spent over 10 years.
Right. And Trump's proposal would only put up 10 to 20% of the cost of those projects, requiring cash-strapped state and local governments to come up with the rest by raising taxes, selling off public assets, or privatizing projects like roads and water systems. Democrats slammed the proposal as another giveaway to private companies. At a recent mayor's conference, Los Angeles Mayor Eric Garcetti criticized a leaked version of the proposal.
Giving us a nickel or a dime for every 95 cents, every 90 cents we put in, doesn't allow you to count our dollars as your infrastructure package. And taking money away from things like community development block grants, existing Tiger grants, New Starts, which helps us build a middle class, doesn't count either.
Trump's infrastructure proposal also severely cuts back environmental impact reviews and local community input. Trump's plan doesn't even mention hardening infrastructure against extreme weather disasters. Trump and the Republicans apparently think you're too stupid to remember that they just gave a $1.5 trillion tax cut to corporations and the rich that could have paid for his $1.5 trillion infrastructure scam.
That's because of the tax and spend Democrats.
Apparently, the tax cut and borrow Republicans. As if to underscore the long-term consequences of not investing in infrastructure, Puerto Rico officials say a major widespread blackout on Sunday was caused by an explosion and fire at an electrical substation. Electricity has been restored to most customers, officials say, but it was yet another setback in the island's recovery 5 months after Hurricane Maria destroyed their decrepit infrastructure, causing the longest blackout in U.S. history.
Any idea what led to that explosion and fire?
That is still under investigation. More than 500,000 Puerto Ricans are still without electricity, and tens of thousands are still without clean water. Also impacting U.S. coastal infrastructure, the rate of sea level rise has accelerated. It's tripled over the past 25 years and will continue to accelerate in coming decades, thanks to the melting of Antarctica and Greenland.
Thanks, melting Antarctica and Greenland.
That's according to NASA. The study has a conservative estimate projecting that sea level rise will surge more than 2 feet by 2100. In the meantime, creating bigger storm surges and saltwater intrusion of fresh water supplies in coastal cities.
Great.
In other news, remember that massive Iranian oil tanker that exploded and sank last month in the South China Sea?
I do.
The New York Times reports that toxic petroleum condensate may have begun to contaminate some of the most important fishing grounds off the coasts of China and Japan. Tests show that fish caught within 5 nautical miles of the sunken ship contained traces of petroleum hydrocarbons. Mm.
And this is a weird spill because it's not like the usual thick crude oil spills. This is kind of invisible.
Right, and it's impossible to clean up.
Invisible except for the damage that it's causing, I guess.
Finally, some good news. In South Australia, Tesla's utility-sized battery storage farm that was built in less than 90 days on a bet is now proving to be so reliable and so cheap during Australia's current record-breaking hot summer that the province is now teaming up with Tesla to build what Tesla calls the world's largest virtual power plant. Over the next 4 years, solar panels and Tesla Powerwall batteries will be installed on 50,000 homes, networked to act as a single solar power plant. It's projected to cut residents' utility bills by 30% because, as Tesla notes, unlike the rising costs of natural gas-powered plants, sunlight is free.
Well, nice to see the infrastructure being improved in other countries, if not ours. For much more on all of these stories and the ones we couldn't get to today, check out our website at greennews.bradblog.com. Find us, follow us, and share us worldwide on the Facebooks and the Twitters at Green News Report. I'm Brad Friedman.
And I'm Desi Doyen.
And this has been your Green News Report.
I've come from a land of love. Read us low and mention love.
Some bumpers are as irresistible as an open flame is to a moth. So, yeah. And I love that Men at Work song. 13 minutes before the hour, and on the heels of a wonderful conversation like that which I just had, highlighting the abuses, among other things, of the Trump administration and ICE, we've got to be careful to remember that there are lots and lots and lots of abuses. And toward that end, I saw earlier today where Carol Baker, Queen of the Minions, did some digging around to find out what's going to go in those food boxes. What food boxes, you might ask? Well, that's why Carol's on the line. Hey, Carol.
Hey, you mean those Blue Apron-like boxes?
Yeah, Blue Apron-like. I don't think there's going to be any filet mignon in those.
Only in the respect that they come in cardboard and taste much like cardboard.
But where did you just the background on this, of course. The Trump administration wants to replace up to half
80%.
I'm sorry. 80% of people's SNAP benefits with boxes, goodie boxes of food.
American Harvest.
American Harvested, growed in America.
That's right.
But you managed to find a list somewhere of what they proposed.
My friend Paula is a very good researcher. And she actually found it, and it's the USDA guidelines of what they want to put in these boxes.
So to have these guidelines, they've been working on this for a little bit.
Well, apparently they do. I need to look because I lost the link. Hold on. I'm getting slammed on Twitter right now.
Oh, have you been a heathen again?
No, what it is the Trumpanzees have been putting up some fake accounts. And if you comment on it, then you get added to all these lists so that they control you. So all of their followers control you.
Nice.
So I've been put on like 22... 100 lists today, and I've been having to systematically get rid of them.
Click, block, click, block, click, block.
Yeah. Yes, that's been my day today.
You remind me of that episode of The Jetsons where George calls home and says, Jane, my button-pushing fingers are absolutely exhausted today.
Yes, that's it. That's exactly it. Hang on. I am... Yeah, here it is. Here it is. Here's the list. The United States Department of Agriculture authorized supplemental food and distribution, rates of food for the commodity supplemental food program. And it goes through and it gives a list of all the things that they're going to give you. So a child can have 36 ounces of cereal a month, or 28 ounces of Farina a month, or
otherwise known as cream of wheat, right? Yeah.
Yeah, or 48 ounces of rolled oats a month, or 5-pound package of grits, and they get one package every other month. So basically 2.5 pounds of grits a month. They can have 2 gallons of juice a month.
Not fresh.
No. Oh, God, no. This is probably like the metal cans of the orange juice.
Right, that tastes like can.
That tastes like can, exactly. They can have 24 ounces of beef a month, or 24 ounces of beef stew, or 24 ounces of chili, or 20 ounces of chicken, or 2 cans of tuna a month.
And understand, this isn't like you check it off and say, this month I'm getting... No, you just get what you get.
You get what you get. Milk, they get... A child can have 2 gallons of milk a month.
Boy, don't drink it all in one place, little Timmy and little Susie.
They get, and they get a 25-ounce package of instant non-fat dry milk every other month.
Tastes great.
Yummo! They get a jar of peanut butter, an 18-ounce jar of peanut butter, or a 2-pound package of dry beans.
Wait.
Yum!
Wait, bean? Wait. Have never, ever... hauled out the loaf of Wonder Bread and smeared some dry beans on it and said, well, this'll do.
Oh, you know. Under potato... Oh, and the funny thing is you watch this, I'm going through this, and it's like grits count as cereal. They count as grains. They count as something else. Oh, and the elderly get basically what kids get. Except they only get 1 gallon of milk a month because old people don't need milk. Elderly are
calcium,
are kind of on
bones, you know. Yeah. I mean, Granny was going to break that hip anyway, right?
Yeah, what the hell? Serves her right. But I'm going through this and they're talking about the food packages, provide a variety of USDA foods to supplemental participants. Diets, but they're not intended to provide for total dietary needs. Now, if you've got a kid with allergies or you have religious restrictions or you have, what if you don't have a stove? What if you don't have a refrigerator? Because not all people have these things. I understand that it's hard to believe.
Carol, we've been down that road here.
Yes, we have. And what happens if they put the box on your porch while you're out doing the mandatory work requirements in order to qualify for that box and they steal it? Somebody steals it. What happens then?
Well, I guess you're just out of luck. I mean, you weren't being exceptionally American and guarding your food with your freedom protector.
You see, I was sitting out on the ledge thinking about all this.
This makes me crazier in the head, and a hog is in the ass, Carol.
You know, and it bears as much resemblance to nutrition as, you know, Uber does to ice transportation. You know what I'm saying?
Well, it does. And I want to believe, and there's that dangerous word again. I want to believe that this is just going to get chucked out on its ear.
Yeah. Well, but I wanted to believe a lot of things were going to get chucked out on its ear that have become our reality, our new reality.
Well, see, that's where I'm going. Because see, there are people in the Congress. When I first read this, I saw all kinds of analysis, Carol. I didn't see anybody remembering something that I remembered. Mm-hmm. And I remember the hissy that Louis Asparagus Gohmert threw a couple of years back when he told the heartbreaking tale, and he told it, I think, on the floor of the House. He told the heartbreaking tale of the hard-working, red-blooded, white American constituent of his who contacted him to tell him about the day that he was standing in the grocery line there at the HEB down in Texas. And he didn't have nothing but some hamburger and dry beans because he's a hard-working American feeding his family. And he's got, and he got some economic anxiety. That's why he goes to his Klan meetings. And he was all upset because there's one of these welfare people, and you could just hear the word, black. Well, that's not the word they use down there, but they was right in front of him there, and they had their SNAP card out, and they was a buying up all the Alaskan king crab legs. And Louis Asparagus Gohmert went and had himself a straight-up hissy fit over them crab-leg-eating pores.
Right.
And, well, one, you can't do that. Your SNAP budget ain't going to buy many Alaskan king crab legs.
No.
And two, it was entirely just a bunch of made-up bullshit. But good God-fearing, upstanding, Bible-believing, Christ-centered, evangelical, fundamentalist, amosexual Christians like Louis Gohmert, they think that it is their God-given duty to tell the poor what to eat.
It's their duty to humiliate and embarrass and basically shame them in every way possible.
Yeah, this is, as Ron and Raleigh points out, this is, subject line says, "Holy Oliver Twist, Batman. Please, sir, can I have some more? Vote for Republicans and you get food in a box." He says, "I still want to know who's going to package this stuff and distribute it. Dystopia, that name is Trump."
Who's going to get the government contracts?
Yeah, this is a logistical nightmare. I mean, he hates Jeff Bezos. Jeff Bezos is Amazon. Amazon's probably the best suited to this at this point in time. But
sure.
But then again, didn't some Trumpanzee lawyer just go to work for Wally World?
Oh, no. That was Rachel Brand.
Oh, Rachel Brand. Yeah.
Yeah, number three at the Justice Department.
Right. So she got the sweetheart deal at Wally World.
Right.
But it's, this is just a manifestation of that loving Christian cruelty that can be found, well, just about anywhere in Trumpanzee land. You know, our buddy Ron and the other Ron, the one in the far frozen north, says, you know, they grow them grits down there in all them red states, right? Right. And here, let me just throw in another one for the fun of it. Anybody want to guess who the biggest corn farmer east of the Mississippi is? Would you happen to know the answer to this, Carol?
I don't know. Mississippi?
No, I mean person.
Oh, east of the Mississippi?
Yeah.
It's not Iowa?
No. Person. Not state, not region, but the person who grows the most corn.
I have no clue.
That would be West Virginia Governor Jim Justice. Trump in overalls, a deadbeat who won't pay his taxes, whose minds are so unsafe they get people killed. He's also the largest corn farmer east of the Mississippi, so all them grits might very well inure to the benefit of Jim Justice.
Wow, I can hear the Trumpanzees now. I worship corn.
We're going to have some wonderful, beautiful, clean corn. Believe me, clean corn is coming back.
Seriously, your last segment was the only thing that, like, made me sane today.
It was wonderful.
Humanity.
I opened the conversation saying, I want to put a spotlight on people who are doing beautiful things in the resistance. That's at the top of the list so far. You know, that's that greater love that hath no man than he would lay down his life for. It. Well, in many ways, Jordan did. He sacrificed. He gave up. He said, "Screw it! I'm not gonna be part of this evil." And I don't know what kind of prize there is out there, like the Nobel or the Goldman or whatever. But that young man has a moral center that needs to be recognized.
Yeah, I mean, it's like a sense of social consciousness that I haven't seen in a long, long time. And it's like at the end of the year, I want us to have a horn People of the Year list, and he's got to be on it.
No, he's probably in the. I don't know how you're going to kick him out of the top five between now and December.
I can't imagine.
Let's see. I'm getting emails here. You got people that want to follow you on Twitter.
Oh, it's at Mo Waterhouse.
M-O.
Yeah. Waterhouse. It was, the Mo was for Missouri, and the Waterhouse was because I lived at the lake, and it kept the trolls off of me.
Troll away, troll be gone. Order yours now. So that at Mo Waterhouse on Twitter.
Yeah.
And that means people will then be able to follow you as you. As you devil Trump and Junior, and by the way, I couldn't help noticing. You think Junior actually participated in one of those "we'll mail your cocaine to you" scams? That was the first thing that I thought when I saw that his poor wife had opened up some white powder. Junior's trying to mail order the cocaine again.
There is something wrong with that boy. And I'll tell you what, Bruce, he takes triple thin skin to a whole new level. That boy, I'll tell you what, he's got followers that will troll you to the end of the earth if you don't, as Omarosa says, bow down before him. I never got over that one.
No. I've been trolling Junior a little bit lately. It's been fun. I generally refer to him as boy, like, boy, you're about as sharp as a sack of wet cement. It just seems to work. Go ahead. I was just going to say that we heard from Ron in the far frozen north again regarding Rachel Brand and Wally World. Ron says the Waltons are big Republican donors, that they are. Would I be paranoid in thinking there might be a connection to Brand getting a job offer she couldn't refuse and removing a potential thorn in Trump's side? They could offer her $1 million a year on a long-term contract, and it wouldn't even be coffee and donut money to the Waltons. That's true. And,
oh, no, it was the first thing I thought of.
And the other part of it is maybe they'll get the distribution contract because there's a Walmart everywhere.
Exactly.
And that might be enough to keep the Waltons from getting all pissed off that they're not getting the SNAP money at the first of the month that they used to get.
Oh, I think the billions they got in the tax cut probably, you know, was enough salve.
Well, I don't know if you saw, but they celebrated by laying off some more workers.
Well, sure, and closing down a shitload of Sam's Clubs.
No. This is new. This is like in the last day or so. They're laying off assistant managers in like the groceries and the cell phone areas. Apparently America's great again now.
Oh, well.
I mean, did you not get the memo?
I didn't get the memo.
So.
course, I don't work there.
But I mean, you'd think that the big grocery chains, because that, you know, by far and away, Walmart's not the only one, would be throwing a purple polka dotted hissy at this. and look, I don't want to tell anybody what to eat or how to eat, but I will say this. I'll say this. In a spirit of bipartisanship, because, you know, we liberals and progressives, we have to be bipartisan, which means, giving in. I'll go so far as to say that SNAP benefits probably should not apply to things like Red Bull and NOS and Monster and all of that stuff. Mm-hmm. I'll give them that. But the other part of it is, in doing this, they also the Trump administration is sticking a knife in farmers markets and places where people can get fresh food. Because remember, on that list you had there, there's no fresh veggies and there's no fresh fruit.
No, but there are. You do get one can of fruit and two cans of vegetables a month.
Hoo-wee. Uncle Jed, that means we can have one green bean a day.
Shitting in high cotton, aren't you?
Ooh, I tell you what, it feels all soft and fluffy. God almighty.
But I mean, that isn't the only thing. It's like I was reading the other day and I came across and it was about a sixth grade school dance. And essentially what it is the children have all been told that the girls are not permitted to say no when a boy asks her to dance. And she was like, no, you've got that wrong. You've got that all wrong. There's no way that can be right. So she went to school and talked to the principal. And the principal's like, no, that's our policy. It's to teach children socialization and inclusion. Really? I think it teaches girls to submit. It teaches boys that no is not an acceptable answer for the girls.
Yeah, that no doesn't mean no anymore.
No, it doesn't mean no. It means I said yes, so I will take by force. I was appalled.
It is appalling. I mean, and you know, we see, you know, that's one teacher, that's one school. But again, in the statistics of a large nation, it's almost impossible that that's not happening somewhere else.
True.
Or somewheres else's. Lots of somewheres. And as the, you know, as the grandfather of a lovely little granddaughter, I'm not real fond of that. I saw that story and it's like, God almighty, really? And of course the answer is yes, really. There's nothing surprising left, Carol.
Sorry, my Twitter is blowing up.
I think a few people are following you.
I think so. Thanks, guys.
Yeah, both of them. Right.
Not cool.
But it's a running gag now. But I've got every day. You know, it's just a. It's a running list of outrage, and what Jordan was talking about is true. I mean, I remember when. Because, you know, this program was on the air during the Reign of Error, and you'd have a couple of you know, pieces of bullshit from the Bush administration, and you know, that's kind of your show.
Mm-hmm.
If I was on the air 8 hours a day now, I couldn't keep up.
No, and it's the death by a thousand paper cuts thing. It's like you can't. This whole diversion thing to keep us away from the Russia investigation, it's just, we will kill everything that you love to where you're bleeding so badly you can't get up to fight us. Because they want us dead. They want us dead. They not only want it all, they want us dead.
Yeah, I mean, realistically, because the conversation started with the food stamp thing. And I'm of a certain age, so I still say food stamps. SNAP. EBTs.
Me too.
But What happens when you get to the end of the food? I mean, because this already exists, Carol. I know you know this.
Uh-huh.
What happens when you get to the end of the food and you're not at the end of the month?
Too bad.
I mean, is everybody just going to have a little MP3, get a message on their phone from the USDA, and it's an MP3 of John Hagee yelling, "Starve!"
Well, it kind of is like that, because I'll tell you, I've interviewed, you know, I did a whole series on poverty for the Opinionated Bitch, and talked to people about how much they get and what they do, you know, to kind of make things stretch. And it's even harder in rural areas, because now you're talking about people who already live in food deserts, who maybe don't have transportation. So it's a 5-mile walk to town, and you can only bring back what you can carry. And I talked to this one woman, and she said, one meal a day so that there are enough for her kids. Because you only make the mistake of running out once before you learn how to stretch everything out. And if you can't pay the electric bill, you know, in the summer, or they shut the gas off and you can't cook it, then, you know, being poor is very expensive, and that's what rich people don't understand.
Yeah, and it's hard damn work.
It is hard work, and it isn't fun, and it isn't something that they actively choose. But poverty is one of those things, like, once you fall into it, it's like the sides of the hole are so slick you can't claw your way out. And so this whole idea of a war on poverty that Bobby Kennedy was so passionate about has turned into a war on the poor. And so how do you fight back when all you've got is your own humanity and a thin blanket over you? How do you fight back? You can't. The power is with the people with all of the money. And so I have a very soft spot for the homeless, and I've worked very hard with them, you know, trying to help them out. The one lady that I've been helping for a couple of years just got into public housing after 2 years of being on the streets last week.
And there are how many empty homes?
Oh,
in this
that
country?
Were foreclosed on thousands, yeah. Tens of hundreds of thousands, and. But the thing of it is in order for her to qualify for that, you would be amazed at the hoops she had to jump through in order to get to all of the appointments, be at all the places they wanted her to, come for this signing. If you didn't get to a specific thing on time, it was all going to fall apart. So it was like, I finally gave up trying to make sure that she had enough bus money and just bought her a monthly bus pass so she could get everywhere she needed to go.
And all of this is it serves no actual purpose.
No.
Especially in an electronic world. The only purpose it serves is to humiliate the recipient.
Of course.
To make sure that they understand that they are not that they're not deserving. It's the equivalent, it's the secular equivalent of preaching a sermon about how, you know, the poor are poor because God wants them to be.
Exactly.
You know, as far as Ron in the far frozen north just chimed in again, he said, end of food versus end of month, you steal, you beg, or you go hungry. All of these options elevate us as a society, right?
Of course.
Yeah, it's character building. Absolutely.
Oh, yeah. And if your kid happens to have a food allergy where some of the enough food that you would ordinarily get, you know, he's allergic to, well, then I guess your child needs to pull himself up by his bootstraps and just not be so fucking allergic anymore. You know what I'm saying? I mean, damn these entitled kids. Because they asked for this.
God, we're a vicious. We are. But that gives rise to another question. You know, Ron said all that corn's raised in all those red states. Yes. But the vast majority of people getting food assistance in this country, contrary to contrary to everything that Ronald Reagan ever tried to get white people to think about the poor in America, the people getting the lion's share of the assistance are working poor white folks. Now, how's that going to play in Trump-Obama or Trump-Mississippi? Or Trump-insaw, or Trump-Zuri.
You follow the lead of the White House. You lie about it. Then you lie about lying about it. Then you blame Hillary. And then you go back and you lie about the reason that you lied. It's what there
is. And then you win.
And then you win. And then... We're lucky enough to meet people like Jordan and people like the Horn family and people like you and people like me. And we're absolutely dedicated to making sure that we don't go down without a fight.
No. And I guess if there's a possibility of this becoming reality, how are people going to pick up the slack? Because this rope is going to be all slack, Carol. There ain't going to be no taut. There's not going to be any starched out. It's all slack.
I know.
And I know what you do out there. And we're going to have, you know, this is that scene from Jaws about needing a bigger boat. We're going to need a lot more Carols.
I don't know. I just, you know, but it's just a matter of getting up every day and deciding that you're going to do the right thing. I will tell you, though, my Republican office mate, who drives me crazy on a regular basis.
Yes.
Came in the other day and he just looked at me and he goes, I can't believe this. He goes, some guy was standing on a street corner and he said he was like so thin that I thought a stiff wind was going to blow him over. He said, so I went up to the corner to McDonald's and I bought a big, you know, burger and some fries and some stuff. He goes, and I took it back to him. And he said, that guy was like, he said, it almost made me cry. And I must have been sitting there with a smirk on my face because he looked at me and he goes, damn you.
It's contagious.
Apparently, it is contagious and I have contaminated him.
Yes, you have.
So, yes, I have. So, and there have been times when the lady that I've helped has, you know, made a wrong turn. And I will tell her no for a while until she straightens up her act. And it's because I was so hard on her and because I was very judicious in how I helped her that, and she even told me that. She said, if you had not kind of force me down this road, then I probably would still be out there. And I said, no. I said, you had to choose to go there. You had every opportunity to never pick up the phone and call me. You had every opportunity not to stop, you know, knock on my door. But you did. And you knew that at some point there was a good chance that I was going to say no, and I did. But you kept coming back.
And she
kind of felt a little bit better about herself after that.
Well, yeah, and look, we sit here and we have these conversations about, you know, a 5-pound sack of grits that work for 2 months. That working people seldom have the time, and in some cases, the knowledge of how to prepare, because even quick grits ain't that quick.
No, they're not, and it's again assuming that you have the means with which to cook them. What are the homeless people supposed to do? I mean, and Bob, when you get right down to it, cereal, farina, grits, oatmeal, it's gruel. It's fucking gruel.
There we go. Yes. it's a step down from porridge. And porridge has some chunky stuff in it, I think.
Porridge? Luxury!
But we're having these conversations when the fact of the matter is there is no excuse at all. And I mean, I'm talking at an extreme here, Carol, but then again, you know, I'm one of those socialist types. There's no reason that this country could not provide a food subsidy for every single human being making less than $100,000 a year. Oh, hell, let's give the subsidy to the J.P. Gottrockses, too. Let's make sure the Trumps get the subsidy. Everybody
eats. You think
those
tax cuts are going to pay for themselves, honey?
Well, yeah, there's that. Because, see, all of a sudden, you know, this latest budget's going to run the deficit up by, what, $1.5 trillion?
Oh, yeah, but they got a half a trillion of that taken out between Medicare and Medicaid.
Yeah, I remember this eight-year span of time where Republicans were scared witless, how could you tell, of deficits. But, of course, they were Kenyan Muslim deficits, right?
Yeah, and Newt Gingrich said that when Republicans are in power, deficits don't matter.
And when a chronic alcoholic has booze, neither does drinking.
Yeah,
and
yeah, like
and yes, I just compared Republicans to untreated alcoholics, and I don't have a problem with that. And no offense to the real alcoholics out there.
I know. I found myself apologizing to pigs and pond scum and all kinds of things lately.
Well, I've taken to referring to them as maggots, and I feel bad for the maggots.
Yeah, no kidding.
Jesus.
No kidding. And did you see in Kansas, now, Governor Brownback from Brownbackistan?
Yes.
He's getting appointed to a Trump position. And so they have, believe it or not, there are no laws in Kansas about who can run for governor. Like, I think a half a dozen 16-year-olds have thrown their hats into the ring.
I saw that. What a lovely idea.
You know, and people are just so appalled by that. You know, they're trying to hurry up and change the law so that they can't do it. And I'm like, look, Sam Brownback was just a kid in a big boy suit, where the budget was shore leave and he played fucky fucky with the poor on a regular basis. I mean, there isn't a homeless shelter in the state of Kansas that I know of that's left.
Jesus, you're not kidding.
I'm not kidding.
So,
and I mean, this is our world.
I mean, it was kind of interesting. I had you know how when you open up certain homepage, certain web pages, you'll get these lists. I ran across one last night called "The Worst County to Live in Each State." You know, because I go to Little Ray of Sunshine websites.
Yeah.
And you know, there were 50. It was a slideshow.
Mm-hmm.
And there were 50 slides of literally the worst counties in each state.
Mm-hmm.
You got to go way through the list to get to West Virginia, and I knew what that was going to be. That was going to be McDowell County,
mm-hmm.
Where 5.2% of the adults in McDowell County have a bachelor's degree. Where the poverty rate is 37.6%. And what got me thinking is that even that poverty rate, Carol, is artificially deflated. The official government poverty rate should be much higher than it is. Because what this is an extreme poverty rate.
Oh, yeah.
But there it was, state after state after state after state. And it's, with a few exceptions, I mean, the worst place to live in Hawaii and the worst place to live in Connecticut are miles above the worst place to live in, say, you know, Alabama or Mississippi or, you know, Missouri.
Sure.
And in every instance, I saw the same thing. Just abandoned people.
Yeah.
And that's what we're talking about in a lot of these counties. Abandoned people.
Sure.
And oddly enough, the life expectancy rate goes down at the same town at the same time.
In Missouri, it's Pemiscot County, and I think they live an average of 6.5 years. They can expect to die by the time they're 72.
How did you know it was Pemiscot County? You're fast.
Because I'm a ninja.
Yep. Poverty rate, 29.1%. Life expectancy at birth, 72.0.
Yep.
And, so, the thing is, I don't care how many tax cuts you give to how many gigantic corporations. Nobody's going to help Pemiscot County. Because we've got this bullshit notion that the only way to have an economy is to have some great goddamn big factory with a bunch of tax breaks.
Exactly.
But we're reaching a breaking point. Tell me if I'm wrong. We're reaching a breaking point where we have to start talking about not minimum wages, but minimum incomes.
Of course.
We have to start talking about feeding people. Without hating them for needing food.
Exactly, and I'm not sure I understand the whole hatred of poor people. I never got that. I guess it's because I was raised one. But, you know, I mean, we were kids. We had no choice.
And
we lived in a very desolate area, and it was a long way to get anywhere, and it was what it was. And, you know, we didn't know we were poor because we were, we were really happy.
Yeah, and that's not to say that there's no happiness in a McDowell County or a Pemiscot County of Missouri or whatever, but that's a different metric, isn't it?
Well, But also, poverty is very different now than it was then. Then it was a much more level playing field because, you know, there wasn't social media and there wasn't cell phones and we didn't live in a world of instant information. And, I mean, you got your news at 6 o'clock at night for 30 minutes from Walter Cronkite. It wasn't this constant barrage of everything. And you know, yeah, you had the few kids in school who would make you feel like shit because you wore the same clothes every day that week. But for the most part, there were enough other poor kids who didn't seem to notice. And you always had friends. But, you know, we live in an age of bullying like we've never seen before. You know, it's you bully the poor and you bully the elderly and you bully women. And you know, it's like it's a fad. And I'm not sure I understand it because I wasn't raised that way.
Well, is that what it is? That you and I and others like us are just sort of cast out of time? Cause see, I'm watching my own state here. And I mean, this is other states have been through similar. Kansas, you mentioned Kansas, mm-hmm. but this state is falling apart before my very eyes. The little town where I live is deader than a stump. And Agnes and I were out the other day, and I just looked at her and said, "I've gotten to where I hate driving through this place. I hate being here." And I wasn't always like this, but I do.
Bob, look at the 55-mile paradigm shift I made in my move. I went from the Trumpiest place in the county, where you had to go a long way to get anywhere and anything, and you were surrounded by a lot of poverty, to living in a community where, you know, there's racial diversity and, you know, people more in my mindset, and, you know, people aren't spray painting the nigger lover on the side of my house in red spray paint while the cops laugh and tell me to stop tormenting, you know, these fine people. And, you know, that's all gone. Hey, Steve. Hey, Steve wanted to say hi.
Oh, Cat Stevens. Yeah, cool.
He's here, my little buddy. But it's like a whole new reality for me in just a, you know, an hour's drive on a good day. But so that in and of itself has kind of been good for me. I mean, yeah, there are things that I miss about my home and being on the water and that kind of stuff, but all in all, I have to say that I feel more human because I'm around more people who have a little bit more basic understanding of what it is. And I mean, and we have abject poverty in this city, make no doubt about it. And there are areas where, you know, African-American citizens have been kettled into these neighborhoods, and they're literally a 5-minute walking distance from some of the most affluent areas in the city. And where you go down onto the plaza, and if you put a dollar into a cup of a beggar, there's a security guard right there to hand you a card telling you, please don't feed the animals. And I'm not kidding about that.
No, that's what it says.
It's just about that bad. I still have the card. I'll have to dig it up and I'll post it on Twitter. But if you go down to the Country Club Plaza and you give a dollar, if you put a dollar in the cup of a beggar, a security guard will come up to you telling you that you are not helping these people. That there are shelters that they can go to. It doesn't matter that there are something like, I can't remember what the figure was. I wrote it up in a column. In fact, that's where I know a picture of the card is. But essentially that all you're doing is keeping them in poverty by giving this to them. And I looked at that little snot, pimply-faced kid who handed me that, and I said, Sonny, you are fucking with the wrong female. I turned around and looked at the homeless man, and I winked at him, and he just smiled. I think he wasn't used to people standing up to them.
Yeah.
How they are here.
Or actually acknowledging their humanity.
Well, the nearest homeless shelter is like 8 miles.
Wow.
The city will only accommodate 10% of the homeless in the shelters.
There's a lot more than that.
Oh, yeah. And one of those shelters is City Union Mission. And if you go to their website, they talk about how many people they, quote, service. If you go in and they pray for you, that's considered a service.
Live on hay, day by day, pray and pray. There'll be pie in the sky when you die.
Exactly. Have some broth and get out. So, you know, every year I go and I buy my case of closeout socks, you know, brand new socks and underwear and stuff. And we take our little tour through the city and hand them out to the guys under the bridges who are genuinely appreciative of something brand new that somebody else hasn't worn before. And you just make the world a little bit kinder for people who don't see much of it.
And in the larger scheme of things, Carol, what I keep kind of coming back to is the fact that how things are and I don't know how many, God knows, no Republicans, okay, no Trumpansies, no libertarians think this way. But I think it's even, I even think that people on the right side of the issues may not approach it this way, and we probably should. The simple idea that this, that the problems that we have, the not problems, people aren't problems.
Mm-hmm.
The fact that we have hunger in the United States, or food insecurities, as it's known now, mm-hmm. the fact that we have people who do not have a roof over their heads in the United States, the fact that we have people who get sick and die of things that can be cured with medicine that's 100 fucking years old.
Exactly.
Is by choice.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. Poverty, first of all, poverty is a manufactured crisis in this country. Hunger is a manufactured crisis in this country. The only thing that we lack to solve it is the will to do it. Because money is not the issue. I don't care what anybody tells you, this fucking country is not broke.
No.
It's not. It's broken.
No. I mean, how many people understand? Look, if you get your, if you get done out of a $10 bill on the Carnival Midway, or if you stop and think that maybe you can finally, you're finally going to win that game of three card Monty.
Mm-hmm.
That's on you.
Yeah.
But there are different games, and for instance, how hard is it to look at $1.5 trillion budget, or deficit rather, and then you hear Paul Ryan say something like, well, you know, we're going to have to cut Medicare and Social Security and Medicaid because we're broke. Well, you broke us, you fucker.
Yeah.
That was intentional thing. Because that was, and this is the light bulb moment. That was the goal all along.
And Bob, we saw it coming. We've talked about this. We said that if they could get their Ayn Rand, it makes me hard wish list, that the first thing they were going to do was slash taxes for the rich and then come after every social safety net program that there was out there saying, we can't afford it. Suddenly, they're fiscally responsible when it comes to poverty.
They're fiscally responsible when it comes to children's rumbling bellies.
Oh, of course. But I have some breaking news for you.
Yes.
There was a special election tonight for the Minnesota Senate, which was a really critical seat for Democrats in a district that Trump narrowly won. The Democrat just won it.
Yes, that's tremendous. And
Carla Bigham, she got it.
Yep. And you hope that you hope against hope that this is going to be a trend.
Well, if what we're seeing right now is any hint, then yeah. But but everything is dependent upon us getting off of our asses and getting out there to vote.
Yeah,
no matter how hard they try to suppress the vote.
And voting in the same direction. I'm sorry, I'm not going to beat that horse tonight, but get through the primaries, support your candidate. And I know that nobody, but Jesus Christ, when it comes to November, mark the box, whoever the person's name is, mark the box that has the D by the name.
Yep.
I don't ever want to hear about Debbie Wasserman Schultz again or the goddamn DNC. You know, we will rearrange the fucking deck chairs as soon as we have closed the goddamn gaping hole below the waterline.
Exactly. It's a one question and IQ test. It's up to you as to whether or not you're going to pass it. But don't make everybody else suffer because, you know, of your ideological purity.
Because there's purity and there's purity. I just had a note from Jenny up in Wisconsin. She said, subject line, Carol. I love my queen. Conversation. Aww. Yeah. See, conversation's sort of making me sad since I just signed up again for Snap, but I love my community congregation. Thank you, Jenny. Thank you so much.
Well, Jenny, don't forget, we're a family, and we help each other.
We do.
So if anything happens and you're in need, all you have to do is speak up.
And I'll turn on the Bob signal. Exactly.
Because we will throw out the Bob signal, and we help each other in this family.
And every time I hear from Jenny, I mention the fact that I never do a program in this studio that I'm not within sight of a magnificent painting that she did and sent home with me from Wisconsin, of the sand hills of Wisconsin before they blew them all to hell. Because, you know, what happens here in West Virginia? What happened in West Virginia didn't stay in West Virginia.
Capitalism.
Yeah, it's what's for dinner. Which reminds me that Ron in the far frozen north, who knows these kinds of things, said, I would point out that agribusiness in the U.S. each year throws out more healthy food than is distributed through the entire food stamp snap communist food distribution system every year. A tax write-off for contributing that same food to food distribution systems would go a long way towards leveling the playing field. But agribusiness is married to a 70-year-old farm credit subsidy system that penalizes such things. It would seem to be time to trot out that old saw about the need for a paradigm shift. Oh,
yep.
Yeah. And look, there. You can't teach everybody to raise a garden, but things like gardening are going to have to come back. And it's really, I saw an interesting, because I get emails from progressive sites and stuff that keep track of this sort of thing. Indoor home gardening is becoming a thing.
Mm-hmm. Out of necessity.
Yeah. But people, I don't know, people who live, maybe it's people who live in states where cannabis is legal now, so they don't need those grow lights anymore. So instead, they've turned the grow lights on and they're growing cucumbers and tomatoes inside the house.
Nope.
And even with grow lights, that's going to be a better tomato than those hard little baseballs that start their lives out green in a crate, and ripen as they make their way from, you know, California to freaking Maine or West Virginia.
Exactly. If they don't rot in the fields, because that's our next new reality.
Oh, that's already here in part at least.
Mm-hmm.
I'm still waiting for some. Some of those Trump voting economic anxiety types to go take jobs picking lettuce and tomatoes.
And meanwhile, they'll be bitching about their $4 potato.
Oh, without a doubt. Yeah. Years ago, I used to plant potatoes here. And then I looked at and I realized, you know, it's cheaper to buy them.
It is.
I mean, now to have some new potatoes that you've just graveled up, that's a thing. But, you know, fresh tomatoes. Yeah, but those days are going to go away. Cheaper, you know, cheaper to buy them potatoes. There's a lot of stuff that's going to go away. And the thing is, we're of a generation, and maybe the next one below us, that knows what's going away. But a lot of it is, I fear that a lot of it is being lost. And that's not me being a, you young whippersnappers don't know how to can green beans.
I do.
But the thing is, Carol, these are taught skills and these are learned skills.
Sure, because we did it growing up. I mean, we had to. We absolutely had to.
And for all the talk about what we need to do is teach our children how to code and write apps when they're in eighth grade so they can go to work and have a minimum wage job in ninth grade. You know, teaching people, if you're going to send people boxes of unprepared food, then teaching them how to cook might not be a terrible idea. In addition to teaching people, and I'm not gooning on STEM, okay? That's wonderful. But I'm an English nerd and an arts nerd, and I believe in the arts too. But somewhere along the way, teaching people how to operate power equipment without sawing off limbs and digits, and, you know, how to make a table out of, you know, wood, if they have to, is probably not a terrible idea.
Exactly.
And those are places where if you sat down and talked to some of those good God-fearing Trumpansies, well, hell yeah, as long as we're teaching them about Jesus, too. And, you know, then you have to negotiate a little bit. Okay, we'll teach them about Jesus and Buddha and Muhammad, God damn it, Sharia law. Okay, easy there, Cletus. Just, you know, stay with the group here. We're going to work through this. But right now they're not in much of a mood for it, Carol. They got the bit in their teeth, and as far as I can tell, they're proud of what they're going to do to the food security program.
Oh, they're very proud of it.
And unlike how we feel about the, and this is the word that was passed along to me earlier from Ron and Raleigh, unlike how we feel about the ice holes, the Trumpansies think that they're doing the work of the angels. And I don't know if you saw this or not, but this is a little bit of horrifying. There's talk out there now of folding ice into the intelligence community.
Oh, shit.
So that they can have access to things like domestic spying.
Oh, what could go wrong?
And wiretapping.
What could go wrong?
And sifting through emails. Hey, this one here. Hey, Cletus, I got an email over here. What's got some of them Mexican words in it? Says something about going out for burritos. Reckon them some illegals?
I must drive them crazy then.
Oh, my email food porn is yeah. They probably think I'm a German German Mexican sushi eater. Yeah, that's what they are. They're sauerbraten rolls. You ever had one of those? A little soy sauce? Yeah.
No, but it sounds wonderful.
Yeah, that's your extreme food porn fusion there, Carol.
Ooh.
Yeah. Well, golly Moses, we haven't talked in a very long time, and I'm glad we did.
We haven't. This was nice. I've been working incredible hours for the off season.
And I'm hoping that there will be some postable photos because, you know, I'm heading out of town Thursday.
Yeah.
Up to the Big Apple. And I think we have a little trip planned so that we're going to wind up taking individual photos of each other, flipping the bird at Trump Tower.
Oh, mama like.
Yeah, that's going to, and maybe even a group photo. Who knows? Find somebody on the street. Hey, buddy, don't run away with my phone. Aw, damn it. Yeah, no. Maybe I'll have to take my selfie stick or something, but I'm looking forward to that because you know everybody should have everybody who's a member of the resistance should have a picture of themselves flipping the bird at Trump Tower.
No kidding.
Do you reckon that's an arrestable offense?
It can't be because I mean they'll have to build more for-profit prisons to get us all.
Oh, by the way, speaking of the white folks going to the economically anxious Trumpansies going to pick stuff, I just got a note. You'll get a kick out of this from Darius. Subject line: White boys. Bob, I work for an orchard in Oregon in the summer. We had a token white boy pick fruit. Day two, sore back. End of white boy.
That's right.
Mm-hmm.
That's right.
Oh, okay. Wait a minute. Now I understand why Cletus over there at ICE was so upset about seeing burrito in the email. Earther tells me, because Earther's always hungry for the next cowbell. Earther says, burritos is Hamas speak for C4 in the Grand Kliegel Lodge. That's what that is. Mm-hmm. God only knows what enchilada means.
I don't even know.
Carol Baker, you have a wonderful evening. Thanks again so much. I'm glad you chimed in because I wanted to. I didn't want to just sit here and scream about the.
You too. Your first guest was just inspiring, and I just appreciated listening.
Oh, he was wonderful. And, you know, I like to harbor the notion that maybe Jordan will just wander back to talk about stuff sometime. He seemed to...
He sounded like that kind of guy where he likes to just talk about stuff. And he's got that intellectual streak in him that, you know, is so attractive to us liberals.
Yeah, he sounded like he settled in and almost got down right at home here, so...
I know.
That's always rewarding. Carol, exactly. you and Steve have a lovely evening. Stay out of the cold if it's even cold there. Heck, it's we were up near 60 today.
It was 50 here, and that's pretty darn fine.
I'm scared to death of freaking March at this point. All right, you take care.
You too, buddy.
All
good
right.
Talking to you.
Good talking to you. Bye now.
Bye, buddy.
The one, the only, the queen of the minions... Carol Baker. There is no one like her, except no substitutes. Well, I didn't mean for this to be a fundraising-free program, especially where the fundraising stands. But I do need to get a couple of thanks out. I wanted to make sure and thank Silent R. Lamar for finishing off last week. You know, he said if we met Chris's Northwest Territories challenge, he'd finish off, and he did. And I wanted to thank Catherine in Arizona for knocking us down by a half a C note. Thank you, Catherine. Thank you so very much. So where do we stand at 8 minutes before 9 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the 13th of February, 2018? It's a little spooky. It's a lot creepy because I don't, well, it's worrisome because... Before I get out of here, there are bills to pay, and there's not enough to pay all the, you know, not enough money to pay all the bills. So right now, the fundraising goal, thanks to Catherine knocking it down, the fundraising goal stands at, take a breath, okay? The fundraising goal stands at $540. That's just where it is. And we need to do that and a little bit more, and then we're done fundraising for February. But it really does need to happen before I get out of here so that I can make sure that, you know, Agnes is going to hold down the fort here and want to leave groceries and kerosene in case it gets cold, and go on a propane run because we don't burn kerosene back here. We burn propane, and internet bill to pay, and a couple of internet bills to pay actually, and got to keep the coal-fired electricity happy. All right, thank you, Darius. Thank you a ton. That's huge. So that takes us down to $490. Thank you, Darius. So if you want to help out, you know, as usual, the PayPal interfaces are over at both headon.live and headonradionetwork.com. At this point in time, checks and money orders take a while to get here, and then Boss Man Wayne has to put them in the bank, and then, well, not the bank, but credit union, and that takes another couple of days for me to pay what I got to pay. It's got to happen through PayPal. I'm sorry. You know how I feel about all this fundraising. I honest to God, I wish there was some other way. Jack in Shreveport with a note. Burritos? How in the hell are those poors eating burritos? We gave them beans and cheese, but they aren't supposed to get any of them Mexican tortilla things. Would you like a quesadilla? Yeah. There we go. By the way, before we head out the door, you know, we do have this day in horn history, and I'm not going to miss it because I get a big kick out of it. For today's edition of This Day in Horn History, brought to you by Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter, encouraging you to try any and all of the various and highly potent bullshit nutritional supplements from Horn Nutraceuticals at Horn Labs on Twitter. We're firing up the Wayback Machine and dialing it a mere 5 years into the past, all the way back to February 13th, 2013. Yes, it's another prayer meeting Wednesday. We have a lot of those. And ecumenical ecclesiasticus Bob Kincaid opens the program with the announcement that, much like today, this will be the last show for the rest of the week. Actually, I'll probably be on the air tomorrow night. That's right. Bob's heading up north to Wisconsin for a few days to sip on some New Glarus beer and gather around the fire pit with his commie friends singing Kumbaya, My Lord Kumbaya. Well, not really. Bob's heading over to Wisconsin to participate in a roundtable on how to keep the coal industry from blasting Wisconsin's Pinocchio Hills to Kingdom Come. You'll know in a short minute why I chose to refer to Bob as Ecumenical Ecclesiastes earlier. The first story of Unfaltering Faith is the story of Brother Reverend Rob Morris, pastor of Christ the King Lutheran Church in Connecticut. Reverend Morris is in hot water and has had to issue an apology letter, not because he diddled any underage congregants or anything. Oh, no. Reverend Morris is receiving large mounds of manure from his own church, the Missouri Lutheran Synod, for having had the audacity to participate in a prayer vigil for the slaughtered school kids at Sandy Hook. What's the fault with that, you ask? Well, according to the Missouri Lutheran Synod, it's heresy for a Lutheran to pray in the presence of people of other faiths. The prayer vigil for the slaughtered children of Sandy Hook was attended by clerics of Jew, Muslim, and oh my God, Baha'i persuasions. Therefore, the Lutheran Synod has given Reverend Morris the choice between issuing an apology letter or taking a walk in the woods. Hallelujah. While Bob has chosen not to run the usual minister of music at the open of this prayer meeting Wednesday, he does treat the Horn Family Community Congregation to the very rare treat of a back-to-back musical interlude, and curiously enough, both songs are performed by the 80s child star duo Robin and Crystal Bernard, the ecumenical movement followed by the Monkey Song, performed back-to-back in the presence of one Jerry Lamon Falwell Sr. The story that really defines this particular prayer meeting Wednesday, however, is one that has been carefully and entirely choreographed by the Goddess of Irony. An Amish cult leader has received a 15-year sentence, I remember this, in a federal pound-me-in-the-ass prison. Apparently, the breakaway band of 7 Amish cult members, under the order of their leader, have taken to walking around the community in the dark, still of the night, restraining other Amish men and shaving their beards off by force. The cult's motivation for doing this is allegedly to instill fear in other members of the Amish community, whose beliefs don't line up in lockstep with those of this particular cult. This story has Bob giddy with comedic possibilities, one of which is Bob playing a contextually appropriate and gut-bustingly funny clip of Bugs Bunny forcibly shaving Elmer Fudd's beard. But the real Goddess of Irony punchline, and the proverbial, welcome to my shop, let me clip your mop, let me trim your top, daintily, sorry. But the real Goddess of Irony punchline and the proverbial rug that ties the room of this story together, oh, lovely reference, is the name of said Amish cult leader, which Bob chooses to artistically not reveal until the end of the segment. Yes, the Amish shaving villain's name is Brother Samuel Mullet. I have no idea how Bob gets through this segment without shooting diet ginger ale out through his nostrils, but between the clip of Bugs Bunny shaving Elmer Fudd and the shaving villain's name being Samuel Mullet, I had a hard time writing this piece, says Brother Deacon Asa, without busting into bouts of squealing laughter, which had other drivers around me quite concerned, and rightfully so. And that was a brief look back into the ghost of Horn past 1,826 days into antiquity for This Day in Horn History. Which reminds me, I got to go to the barber shop tomorrow, too. And now we're out of time. Yes, indeed, that was the trip to Wisconsin where I met Jenny, and Jenny met me. Exactly. That's wonderful. I'm glad you remember, Jenny. Thank you. Here we are at the end of the program. And again, $490 to go in fundraising for the evening. Hopefully it'll get better. Thanks to our all-volunteer staff. Thank you to Sparky and Steve from Georgia Stan in the chat room. Thank you to our news ninjas. Thank you, Brother Deacon Asa, headon.live. Thank you to our buddy John Fox in Australia. Thank you to Ben Birch, WhiteRoseSociety.org. Thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the men and women of Cold River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And always, 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 Gina, it's all for you. Later, everybody. I'll probably be here tomorrow night.